brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about, for all you hockey fans out there, it looks like the NHL is going to drop the puck, or at least on the ice this year after all. We're going to talk about the lockout and what it means. Also, talk about the growing number of lockouts that we've seen, not just in professional sports, but across the nation, as employers don't let a good crisis go to waste. You know, because you can't let that go to waste. You've got to take advantage of not only the crisis, but also our bizarre labor laws. We're going to talk about that. Also, the hysteria from the gun lobby in full tilt boogie, full tizzy mode. The gun nuts are, doing what they do. Doing exactly what they do. Proselytizing. You say, oh, they're coming. Oh, we got to save our guns. And prophesizing that the jackbooted thugs are going to be going house to house, confiscating every squirt gun, every air rifle, every slingshot. Oh, they're coming. And what's happened is the rational voice has been completely drowned out by the screaming. Can't have a rational discussion on this because, you know, the money... Here, over here is the shiny thing. So we're going to talk about that as well. I want to be outraged about something, really, honestly, truthfully. Just the thought that AIG, the possibility that AIG was going to sue you and me for bailing them out. Now, they've decided probably shouldn't because, you know, the whole we're grateful. Oh, thank you. Remember, thank you, America? The ad campaign, they're kind of down the toilet at this point. Because that thank you turned into a screw you, and, well, generally not a good ad buy when one's going on at the same time. So I'm also going to see that, and we're going to talk about the housing market, still struggling to recovery. Millions of homeowners still underwater, the banks settling for pennies on the dollar, running away from what they've created, leaving us, that means you and me, we the taxpayer holding this big steaming pile to clean up. Maybe some drastic measures are needed. Maybe common sense. We shall decide. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the big day at the farm show, more headlines from the Patriot News. And, you know, I don't know why I pick on the poor Patriot News, but the reality is this seems to be the bane of their existence at this point. Just everything you see. Oh, well, you know, the great grape stomping headline. There's grape stomping going on. And there's, there's a competition to call bids. Can do that. Lots of great stories, lots of stuff. Not really much substance, a lot of fluff. Which sadly, you know, the area's largest newspaper is spending most of their time on fluff. I guess there was a gun. Forum, there was a discussion on gun safety here in the Harrisburg area, and simultaneously there was a shooting. And as my producer had pointed out, Patriot actually sent one reporter to the forum, and he said, you know, had the shooting happened, had someone shot a duck in the head, all of the reporters would have probably converged on that, because it could have gone in with the farm show. Yeah. Good stuff. And, you know, the sad reality is, you know, I look at these stories and, boy, there's just so much more that could be done over there. I don't know. Anyway, big news today. Nixon turned 100 today. And as I was sitting, when I saw this, I thought, you know, I remember when Reagan turned 100. And I remember, you know, all of the hoopla, all of the pomp, all of the circumstance, the celebrations, there were documentaries, there were all kinds of stuff. And I go, you know, the sad reality is here we are looking at the Republican Party that, you know, Reagan and his ilk really took down an extreme path. And you've got people going, wow, Nixon wasn't such a bad guy. And I've actually had interesting conversations recently with people who are trying to rewrite the Nixon legacy. I had an uncle of mine who said, well, what did Nixon do that was all that bad? He just lied. No one got killed. And I guess if that's your bar, well, you know, very little of what goes on could actually be bad then. But I started thinking about some of the things that Nixon actually did. And what a difference between the Nixon era and the current Republican era. You know, you go back and you think about Nixon, who actually wanted to, I don't know, maybe protect the environment a little bit, Clean Air, Clean and Water Act under his administration, the Endangered Species Act, established the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, the job-killing organization of America. That was Nixon. And you tell that to people, no, that's not it at all. No. Never. That's not it at all. And you think about this whole debt ceiling debacle. And one of the richest guys in the House, a guy named Daryl Issa, head of the Oversight Committee, chairman there, probably the richest guy in Congress, when he stood up to give his little minute speech, he didn't say, well, you know, we need to worry about the fiscal cliff or the fiscal mirage, or we got to do this because it's good for the country. No. He said, how we fix this is we need to have chain CPI. We need to lower money going to my grandmother. We need to slow the cost of living. And you go, well, why is that important for Nixon? Nixon was actually the guy who expanded Social Security and expanded Medicare to millions of seniors. Because he was the guy who tied inflation to Social Security, so that as inflation went up, benefits went up. So you didn't have what we've allowed to happen to the minimum wage and a lot of things, where over time inflation erodes them and eats them away. Nixon did that. And in fact, he actually proposed giving low-income families guaranteed supplemental income, much like the earned income tax credit, only a little bit more direct and not tied to, oh, you have to have a job. And I think about this and I go, wow, you know, I pine for that Republican Party. I pine for the party of Nixon now, or of Eisenhower especially. And you think about the things that he did, you know, on the education front. You've got the Republicans now wanting to privatize and destroy public education. Nixon was a guy who lobbied to expand federal funding for inner city schools. He was one of the guys who believed in child development projects. Introduced the Equal Education Opportunities Act. And you go, well, but he was a horrible racist. Yeah. Sure, okay, he was deeply racist, according to a lot of reports. But you know what? He was one of the guys who pushed to include federal minority employment quotas, which now you've got, oh, I don't know, the right wing in this country nuts over quotas because affirmative action is destroying the country, they say. Nixon signed Title IX so that my daughter is going to have opportunities that she wouldn't have had before this. And I guess it's easy to forget where we've come from. I guess it's easy to forget that, you know, a lot of the stuff that we've taken for granted for all these years, someone had to put it into place. Here, it's Nixon. So when I hear people say, well, you know, Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, Eisenhower was a Republican, yeah, but they're not these Republicans. They're not. It's just, it's mind-blowing. But happy 100th birthday, Tricky Dick. I hope there's room for you somewhere. A couple of interesting emails yesterday on our gun discussion. Someone sent me one saying conservatives getting rid of the welfare system because some people take advantage of it is like getting rid of the Second Amendment and banning all guns because some people use them for criminal purposes. He asked the question, do you get it now? And, you know, no, they're never going to get it. It's just not going to happen, so don't bring it up. What I keep hearing, though, is, you know, and I heard it again, you know, Nazi, Stalin, Mao, you keep hearing all of these names, Obama's like, and they keep trying to tie it. I saw one of the shows on Fox today. They had some right-wing talk show host on there going, well, you know, it's like Hugo Chavez. And you know, basically his argument is that if we do anything, we're going to be like Nazi Germany. He said, it'll be like, give us your papers, please, like Nazi Germany. And I said, well, where was he when Arizona was actually passing a papers, please law. And no, nothing there. No rational thought there. Just vitriol and anger. Just screaming. And I got an email yesterday about Bill's call, who said, you know, and as Bill was talking yesterday, and one of the things that stuck out in my mind is he had said that the AR-15 was not used. It was left in the car, if I remember him right. And at the time, I hadn't remembered the story, but I'm almost positive, and Andy points out that the AR-15 was actually used. And a couple other things that Andy wanted to correct in Bill's statement yesterday that, look, I didn't know, and I'll be honest, I didn't know that the school, if the school was open or if it was locked. Andy points out that the school was locked, and this guy actually broke through the locking mechanism to get into the school, which I guess, according to Andy, tripped the alarm system. And Andy points out a couple of interesting things. You know, he says by banning these high-capacity magazines and clips, it would go a long way in giving bystanders a chance to actually defend themselves. And that's kind of the thought I've had on this. You know, you got the old six-shooter, sure, you go six shots, you know, okay, now you got a chance to rush him. Oh, but what if he's got two? Well, I mean, there's something there. But, you know, at the end of this, you know, Andy points out that in Australia, back in 1996, I believe it was, he says there was a fatal shooting of 35 people there, which brought about strong gun laws. And they had used an exchange program to bring guns in exchange for some other things. About 650,000 guns were brought into Australia. And as Andy points out, there's not been one mass shooting since 1996, since they enacted some reasonable legislation. And I think Australia is kind of a lot like us in the idea that they're a gun culture as well. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about this because there were some things that came out, some conversations that I've had on the constitutionality. I've always believed that the Constitution says you have the right to bear arms. It ain't well-regulated militia. The right has pushed back. No, there's a comma there. We're going to find out when we come back. Stick around. We're going to take a quick break right back with the gun discussion after this. And take my hand. All they want to do is...
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A potential class action lawsuit could determine how responsible companies need to be when it comes to third-party contract labor. Jesse Russell reports.
A federal judge has ruled that Walmart can be included in a class action lawsuit filed by workers for a contract warehouse. The Inland Empire, California warehouse is operated by Schneider Logistics, and the employees have targeted the company with allegations of wage theft. While Walmart doesn't directly own the warehouse, the workers argue that the company has ultimate say over how the workers are treated and could apply pressure to ensure they're treated right by contractors. The world's largest retailer has argued that the workers aren't employed by the company, but Walmart is still taking the concern seriously. Walmart is putting in place auditors to inspect contractors in the United States. The case could determine how involved major corporations who rely heavily on contract labor are responsible for how workers hired by their contractors are treated.
The Labor Combat Organizing College's mission is to increase the number of non- and anti-union company signatories to union construction jobs and to do it without going through the National Labor Relations Board. Danny Caliendo is the Labor Combat College's lead instructor. Labor Combat uses tactics and technology to train organizers, primarily in the building trades. Caliendo says that the Labor Combat College's tactics are designed to be highly effective in so-called right-to-work states to fight for better wages and benefits for building trades workers.
The day you stop fighting for your rights to have a living wage and to have a good benefit and so on and so forth, the day you're going to die. And we've been dying slowly, unfortunately, for for the better part of 3 decades, and 24 right-to-work states kind of emphasize that fact. We've had 102 people through the program since May. They have a money-back offer. They don't like what they hear. They think it's BS. Don't pay us. We haven't not had a check given to us yet.
The International Association of Machinists is at GKN Aerospace in Amityville, New York today, campaigning for support from the workers in a union representation election to be held Friday, January 11th. The IAM says the company has hired union-busting consultants to wage a relentless anti-union campaign. The union says two pro-union workers were fired just before Christmas. The IAM has contracts with GKN Aerospace facilities like in St. Louis, where the union workers make about $5 an hour more and pay 30 to 40% less for their health care. This newscast, made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers, the OPEIU, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And I'm proud to say that we are going to support the president, the next president of the United States, by casting 67 votes for Mitt Romney and 5 votes for Paul Ryan.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Interesting story out of Florida. Communications professor at the University, the Florida Atlantic University, had written, it was an interesting, you know, I guess you get these blog posts, people want to write outrageous stuff. He came up with this idea that it's not unreasonable to suggest that the Obama administration had complicity or direct oversight of an incident that has a very short order sparked a national debate. His argument is that, well, one, his argument that, well, the shooting may not have happened because we haven't actually seen pictures. And then secondly is that if it did happen, and we're not sure that it did, but if it did, that Obama wanted it to happen and put people in there to maximize all of this. And he's not backing down from it. And look, hey, say what you want. But I think it's kind of crazy. And this whole gun debate, all of this, how many more of these do we have to have? That's why I've asked our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, to come help me work through this whole gun issue and maybe think about where we should be going. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good to be here. How are you?
I am good. You know, when I heard this, I was on vacation when the shooting happened up in Connecticut, and I got to be honest, I hugged my kids a little closer, and you know, it really affected me through most of my vacation.
Well, I understand. It's, you know, we all were doing the same kind of thing, and my kids are a little older than your kids, and we were reaching out and hugging them and our grandchildren, too. And it's a very scary thing, this whole notion of the Second Amendment has been turned on its head and it's upside down. And as a gun owner, and I own several guns and I'm licensed, I have a concealed carry permit. I have a federal firearms permit, which is a pretty rare thing. So I'm not anti-gun, but we need to wake up and deal with a fundamental idea about this. Something has gone terribly wrong, and those in the NRA who are advocating in true insanity by arming schools and school employees need to be exposed for what they are, and we need to begin to deal with what this right is that people frequently point to, but very few people read about, understand, articulate.
I've always said that most people can read the first half of the sentence. Yes, you have the right to bear arms. But I say the second half of the sentence is in a well-regulated militia. Yet most of my gun friends, wow, that doesn't apply. So settle this for me because, you know, as I'm reading it and it seems very clear to me, I've got a whole industry telling me, no, that doesn't apply.
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. It's an industry. This is one of those several concepts that are really unique in American life. We have one interest group agitating another broader group to do its bidding. So here the NRA, which is really a trade association for the companies that manufacture weapons, predominantly pistols, handguns, rifles, shotguns, revolvers, somehow or another turning this constitutional provision on its head and suggesting that the right to bear arms is unlimited, unfettered, unchecked, and fundamental to the core of American democracy. But Amendment Number 2 says with great specificity what it's about. And it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, a militia is what's known as a citizen's army. If one takes the time to look up the definition of the word militia, that's a citizen's army, to be contrasted, of course, with a professional army. Now, if we take our time and look back to 1787 and 1788, when the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution were written, and all done in response to the adoption of the Constitution and the repeal of its predecessor, the Articles of Confederation, we begin to get a sense of what this is about. Under the Articles of Confederation, the several individual states were sovereigns, and they were confederated basically as a trade treaty among the 13 colonies, then states, to allow free trade past their individual borders.
Which some conservatives still argue our Constitution still is.
Yeah, yeah. Some argue that our Constitution should be interpreted that way now. You're absolutely right. And we've talked about that in other contexts. But we adopted the Constitution, and contemporaneous with the adoption of the Constitution, we adopted the first 10 amendments to make clear the respective roles of the states and the federal government. And the notion of a well-regulated militia is to be contrasted with the notion of a full-time professional army. And in the late 1700s, a full-time professional army in other countries of the world was used generally to compel enforcement of the government's laws on the people who would not otherwise follow them. It was used as a force of the government to put down the people. And that was fundamentally contrary to the then bully experiment that was to be the United States, where the people granted power to the government instead of the government granting power to the people. And the Constitution really is a series of grants of power from the people to the federal government and a series of limitations and restrictions on that power. So the right to bear arms is a very narrow, limited right under the Constitution and the Second Amendment that is all aimed at the notion of a well-regulated militia being available in contrast to a standing professional army. If the right to bear arms was unlimited and unfettered, as the logical extension of the NRA and Wayne LaPierre argument must be taken, then all of us would be going out day in and day out and buying our own stealth bombers, our own cruise missiles, our own Tomahawks, our own armored personnel carriers, our own submarines, our own nuclear torpedoes, and our own atomic bombs, because those are arms. Obviously, we have already agreed over decades, over centuries, that we can regulate and limit and restrict those kinds of things. So the question gets to be, what's it for? Now, people will assert their right to hunt, but there's no constitutional right to hunting. Okay? The Second Amendment doesn't address the right to keep and bear arms for the purpose of hunting or feeding one's family. It's only for the narrow, limited purpose of maintaining a well-regulated militia to assure and secure the freedom of the people.
So if as you've laid this out, if that's correct, which I don't doubt it is, how did we get to where we are now where people think that, wow, it's my unfettered right to have whatever, if I want to have an M16 or an AK-47, I should have that right?
Well, we got there most recently in the most current iteration over the last generation or two in an opinion written by Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. An intriguing opinion because Mr. Justice Scalia, claims to be that most specific justice, jurist, member of the Supreme Court who has fealty to and commitment to the originalist theories of the framers of the Constitution. And he claims in virtually every opinion that he writes that he goes back to what was known by the framers and what was intended by the framers in 1787, in 1789. And it's astounding to me, but in an opinion of the adopted by a majority of the Supreme Court and authored by Justice Scalia, Justice Scalia makes a quantum leap without basis in interpreting the Second Amendment to confer upon people an individual right to bear arms. But interestingly enough, Amendment 2 doesn't say anything about an individual right to bear arms. It talks about the people, plural, the group, having a right to keep and bear arms for the purpose of maintaining a well-regulated militia. Nothing less, but nothing more.
Right. Now, help me here, because my understanding of that period is the founders were obviously, as you pointed out earlier, not a big fan of a standing army. In fact, the only branch of the military, if my memory serves right, that was supposed to be standing was our Navy to protect shipping lands. Isn't that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And the Navy in that time was the preeminent military force for national defense.
And given that everybody was supposed to be in the militia, so everybody had this right to have the gun, but for purposes of being in the militia, if I'm getting this right.
Well, you're not only getting it right, but in context, socially, professional soldiers were looked upon as mercenaries and looked down upon, whereas citizen soldiers, members of the militia, were carrying out a very high civic duty and were viewed as such. And that is indeed the difference. And that is also the difference between the militia and the Navy, because the Navy was there to protect our borders.
So, you know, let me ask you this. Now, the NRA came out with this idea because, you know, I want to try and figure out how do we solve this problem. I don't want another classroom shot up. I don't want a movie theater shot up. I don't want firefighters going to a fire and have some crackpot shooting at them. You know, where do you go from here? I mean, the NRA came up with this great idea. Let's put a gun in every classroom. We see Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona sending out 3,000 vigilantes to go and patrol the 50 schools in the area. To me, that is trouble waiting to happen.
It's trouble and there's no wait. It's happening. It's scary and it's happening. There is no basis upon which anybody can articulate a citizen-based need to own an AR-47 or an M15 or any weapon that has a drum or a 30-round magazine of 223, you know, shells. And part of the where we go from here is there has to be some holistic regulation. Part of it has to be regulating gun ownership and registration, as has been done in every other civilized democracy. But right on the heels of that, we have to do some other things. We need to really take another look at who qualifies and what the circumstances are to qualify to own a weapon, a killing machine, and our mental health system, and recognize that that system has been decimated going back for the last 40 years when we started on this whole process of what is known as deinstitutionalization, where we closed the state hospitals here in Pennsylvania, without having first put into place a community-based system for people who need that.
Yep.
We, as a society, somehow or another, believe that it's appropriate to treat cancer and that we have a societal responsibility to treat cancer. We believe that it's appropriate to treat heart disease, coronary artery disease, and that we have a societal obligation to do so. We believe the same thing with respect to diabetes and to Crohn's disease and to a host of maladies that afflict major swaths of society. But somehow or another, we cast mental illness as something else, and we embarrass people with it. And we need to deal with that. And if we need laws to deal with that, we need to begin to pass those laws and adopt those laws as well.
Yeah.
And then finally, if, as we must in the short run, deal with the Scalia opinion that cuts out of whole cloth and creates an individual right to bear arms, we must do something else. And maybe the something else is that we heavily, heavily, heavily tax ammunition the same way as that we have decided to heavily tax cigarettes. So that if you can keep a gun and you can keep an AR, maybe it gets to be very expensive to keep the rounds of ammunition that you would use in that AR.
Well, I'm sure the gun people would be very unhappy with it. Can you stick around through the break?
Well, you know, they may be unhappy, but I got to tell you, I wasn't related to, much less a parent or grandparent or sibling or uncle or aunt of one of those dear little children who were murdered because they went to school that day.
Right.
And I'm pretty upset. And I'm pretty upset about the gun advocates who are sticking their head in the sand and refusing to deal with this. In England, when there was a gun problem 35 years ago, they adopted gun control legislation, strict gun control legislation. Even the police, the bobbies in England, don't carry guns. Do not carry guns. And per capita, the number of gun crimes in England, as compared to the United States, is only about 10% of what we have. It works.
Yeah.
We're not going to take guns away from everybody. They're going to be bad guys. But if we make it harder, we make it more challenging, we do something about these gun shows and the gun show loophole, we do something about assault weapons, and that's what they are. Those are killing machines. They're nothing more than killing machines. We do something about all of these irrational pieces. And if somebody wants to have a pistol or a revolver at home for personal protection, somebody wants a shotgun for recreational hunting within reason, after demonstrating and passing a test, you know, training, things of that nature, maybe we have something here. And maybe we have some reconciliation where we meet in the middle between and among those who say no guns and those who say all guns. But right now we have a perversion of the law, of the organic law of the country, and that is being used as a crutch and an excuse to scare people from going to the movies, to scare families from sending their children to school, to scare citizens from assembling with their member of Congress on a Saturday morning in a sunny community in Arizona. Something needs to be done. Something must happen. It cries out. And what we have instead is a group of legislators, Democrats and Republicans alike, who are being intimidated by a representative group of a minority of within a minority of the citizens of the United States.
Let's go to the phone lines. I got Bill on line one. On line two, he's got a question for Irwin. Bill, thanks for taking time for us. What's on your mind?
Sure. Hi, Rick. Hi, Mr. Aronson.
I'm not Mr. Aronson. That was my dad. I'm just Irwin, Bill. Good to hear your voice.
You're clearly a lifelong student of the law and devoted to the principles of the law, as I can, you know, at least as you interpret them. What I'd like to know your opinion on, and what I'd like to say has perhaps caused a lot of paranoia, if you want to call it that, among a lot of people, Rick would call right-wing. How about executive orders? How about the president being able to send troops all over the world without the approval of Congress. How about the Patriot Act, the surveillance state, which is very rapidly being erected? And I don't see, you know, I understand that you are a devoted American, a loyal American. You believe in the Constitution as you interpret it. How can you justify those things, which I think are an awful lot more important than individual gun rights anyway?
Thanks for the question, Bill. Well, what do you say? What do you say, Aaron?
Well, Bill, you're not going to get a disagreement from me. I mean, my read of the Constitution is the president should not be permitted to send troops anywhere in defense of the United States absent an act of Congress declaring war. And that's the way that it is. Now, the Congress adopted something known as the War Powers Act some years ago that confers upon the executive branch some limited right to engage in war powers absent a declaration of war. And it may be that that's the kind of thing that needs to be revisited. Intriguingly enough, we've been admired in 10 years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq. We're winding down ostensibly now. And there were any number of things that happened. There was some debate in Congress, but there was never a declaration of war. Never a declaration of war as contemplated by the Constitution. And I think that's very troublesome, and I think that it's not a small deal. I think it's a very big deal. But somehow or another, the very same members of Congress who are quick to refuse to do anything about guns in this country turn their back on this usurpation of the legislative branch's duties, not just rights, but duties, under the Declaration of War provisions of the Constitution. And by the way, that's in the Constitution. That's not an amendment, as Amendment Number 2 is on the right of the well-regulated militia to have the people keep and bear arms. So I think it's a very significant question. I think it's well put and well raised, and it is every bit as significant as anything we might do. Recognize that there are 6,000 of our finest children who are no longer with us because of this war without a declaration that we fought for the last 10 years. And there are another, 35,000 to 45,000 young people who have come home crippled and maimed and amputees and emotionally shocked as well, all without a declaration of war. And then there are, I don't know how many hundred thousands of Afghanis and Iraqis who have been killed, crippled, maimed, or otherwise violated as a result of this undeclared war. And it wasn't the first. It wasn't the only one. The Korean conflict was not a declared war. Vietnam era, from my time, was not a declared war. Indeed, the Second World War and the First World War were among the very few that were actually declared wars, as was the War of 1812 and the Spanish-American War. Those were actually declared wars. But we've done this a lot, and we seem to deal with these things in a twisted up way.
Yeah.
Here I sit in Harrisburg, 20 miles from Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, we have this stellar facility. People come not only from throughout the United States, but among our allies to attend the U.S. Army War College. And it's always been a curiosity to me why we do not have a U.S. Army Peace College.
Good question. Does that answer your question, Bill?
Well, I would like to ask Mr. Aronson just to elaborate a little further, and I'm glad he used the word. At what point does the usurpation of power become tyranny? Because I think we're moving very rapidly towards it.
That's an interesting question, Irwin, because, you know, a lot of people on this gun issue especially have asked, you know, what do we do with the government? Because we were supposed to be able to overthrow the government. And if they take our guns, we won't be able to overthrow the government. Bill brought that up last night. In context with what Bill had to say, you know, what are your thoughts?
Well, if the notion of my being able to have a 30-06 somehow puts me to overthrow the government, then I've missed something along the way, because the last time I checked, the government, at my expense, and indeed because of the way things have happened in the last decade, at the expense of my children, grandchildren, and probably great-grandchildren through borrowing. The government owns nuclear submarines. The government owns Tomahawks. The government owns cruise missiles. The government owns bombers. The government owns F-16 fighters. The government owns tanks, armored personnel carriers. These are things that the citizens don't have. These are things that the people in the United States do not have access to generally. Way on top of, you know, the M16 genre of weapons, or the AK genre of weapons, or the AR genre of weapons. So the notion that with my little 9mm gun, I'm going to somehow be protected from the tyranny of a government that has all of that armament is charitably described as misplaced at best. And we have long since passed the notion that the government is not permitted to regulate the citizens' use or access to those kinds of weapons and weapon systems, because that's exactly what we do.
Right.
People don't tend to have a nuclear bomb sitting around in their basement for personal protection. And indeed, if they attempted to have one, it would be illegal, and they would be incarcerated in violation of the anti-terrorism laws.
So in bringing this around and bringing this to a close, you know, because I'm not someone who wants to be taking people's guns. I think there's got to be a way of making sure that law-abiding citizens like you, like others who want them, can have them and be responsible with them and treat them as you pointed out, these are killing weapons. And treat them in the right way, but also making sure that not every Tom, Dick, and Harry can get one.
Well, not only making sure that not every Tom, Dick, and Harry can get one, but also making sure that the people who do get them with training. In Israel, because they have a military draft, and conscription is universal, and every 18-year-old, male or female, with the exception of those who have a religious objection or a physical disability, spend time in the military, everybody is trained to and therefore respects the notion of what weapons are for. People in Israel, by the time they're 18, 19 years of age, know that you never point a weapon at somebody else unless you intend to kill that somebody else. Period. And that's a pretty breathtaking and compelling notion. In the United States, what I need to qualify to get a gun is to be able to walk into a sporting goods store and present my photo ID and not have anything pop up in a criminal background check, and nothing more. Nothing that says I understand what a gun is, much less I found a method by which to respect it. And there's no limitation on how much ammunition I may buy for that weapon, or how many magazines, if it's a semi-automatic, I may buy, or how large those magazines may be.
Yeah.
We can do this, okay? If we have the will to put a man on the moon 40 years ago, 45 years ago, if we have the will to build medical machinery that allows us to look into the human body without any intrusion whatsoever in an MRI or a CT scan, we have the will to regulate this insanity.
You know, I go back and you brought up in Israel, the conscription, and everyone has to be part of the army. You know, I go back to the beginning of the country, and it's my understanding that that's kind of what they wanted here, that everyone was in the military or in the militia. In fact, you know, I point to a 1792 federal law that, made it mandatory that every free, able-bodied white male citizen 18 to 44 be enrolled in the state militia and provide himself with a good musket or firelock and a certain amount of ammunition and a certain backpack. And they had a whole laundry list of things that if you were 18 to 44, you had to own. And you were in the militia.
No question about it. But intriguingly enough, what was happening in that period of American history was that the federal government had conferred upon it, by the Constitution and through the Second Amendment, the capacity to activate the individual state militias and assign them to other states for the purpose of protecting the right of citizens to their freedom. Okay. It wasn't so that anybody could put down a rebellion or engage in a rebellion against tyranny, and it wasn't for the purpose of running into the then little red schoolhouses and opening fire. So the framers did get it. The trade organization that covers itself as the NRA doesn't exactly get it. And the stridency of Wayne LaPierre in coming on Meet the Press, or conducting a press conference with a response by suggesting that we arm all the teachers in the schools, is just missing the point. It just doesn't get it.
No, as a
parent, as a grandparent, I need to be secure that if I send my children to school, that they're going there to learn about reading and writing and arithmetic, not about where you hide in the school building when some nut comes in and opens fire with a killing machine.
Well, I'm sure this debate will continue on. I got to take a quick break here. It's been interesting and enlightening, and I appreciate the time, Irwin. It's always great talking with you.
Good to talk with you as well, and thanks for the call, Bill. I hope you're still listening, and we'll talk to you next week, pal.
All right, let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com. Good news, America. At last, scientists are grappling with a persistent affliction that can strike without warning, causing anxiety for millions of families every year. It's the tragedy of needle drop. No, not drug injection needles. Christmas tree needles. Each December, you search out the finest and freshest conifer, pay good money for it, give it water and love, decorate it beautifully, and how does it repay you? Within 2 to 4 weeks, the ingrate is shedding needles all over your carpet. It's the scourge of Christmas, I tell you. But take heart, for your tax-funded land-grant colleges are on the way to rescue you and all other needle drop sufferers. Specifically, plant pathologists at Washington State University, North Carolina State, and elsewhere have mounted a $1.3 million RNA sequencing trial. They're sampling branches from thousands of trees in search of that one nucleotide polymorphism that controls needle drop. This heroic mission requires remarkable attention to detail. For example, in Puyallup, Washington, a research specialist lifts each of several thousand sample branches in her lab one by one, rubs her fingers up and down each stem, then counts the needles that fall from each one. Another specialist enters the number into an ever-spreading spreadsheet. It's a tedious job, but someone has to do it. Or not. Really, of all the problems facing American consumers and agriculture, should Christmas needle retention be this high on our list of research priorities? Well, responds the chief needle drop pathologist at Washington State, the Christmas tree industry is a $1 billion industry. This is Jim Hightower saying, exactly. So let this profitable industry pay for its own research, rather than diverting our tax funds and government scientists from more important work that will produce much greater public benefit.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Interested in your thoughts on this. You know, the more I think about this gun issue, and look, I'm not somebody who wants to go door to door taking people's guns. I don't want, you know, the guy who's got a gun in the corner in the drawer or whatever, you know, or one that's been passed down through generations who's responsible. Nobody wants you to lose those. Nobody wants, he's even talking about taking those away. That's not the discussion. And I guess I come at this from a little bit different perspective. As I've said a number of times, I grew up in a housing project in the west side of Cleveland where the criminals had guns, where angry people had guns. And you know what? Some of the people doing the shooting, they didn't start off as criminals. And I remember the shootings that went on and the knifings and all of the violence and all of that stuff. But one of the things during the break my producer reminded me of, and it's, you know, completely slipped out of my mind now. When I was driving a truck for a living, I would go up, this was in Providence, it was up near Providence, a place called Lincoln, Rhode Island. Ended up, you know, drove the truck up there and went, dropped all the stuff off, went to the hotel. And as I pulled into the hotel place I always parked, I chose not to park in this particular spot where I had parked almost every time I've ever been there. But I got out of the truck to get my stuff out, and I heard bang, bang. And, you know, not more than, you know, 50 yards from me, guy hits the ground. It was a handgun. I mean, it was a legally owned handgun. Maybe it was legally owned. I don't remember, to be honest. But this was a crew from Florida that came up to build a church, oddly enough. And the guy who did the shooting worked for this construction crew, and the guy who got shot was the foreman. And evidently there had been a fight during the day on the job where evidently someone moved the shooter's shirt. A fist fight broke out. The foreman sent the guy back to the hotel room where he got all drugged up and cracked up, and when the foreman came back, bang, shot him. And I remember watching this unfold, because here's the guy laying on the ground dead, the shooter running towards the hotel, and I remember looking in the hotel, him pointing the gun at the clerk, and I'm going, man, this is not good. And some weird things happened, and I don't know what he was thinking. He went outside, threw a bunch of shots into the air, handed the gun to somebody, and ran off into the woods. And I remember going over, looking at the guy laying on the ground with a whole bubble, with basically his life bubbling out of his chest. By the time I went back to him to see if he was okay, he was dead. And up came the police at that point, pointed the shotgun at me. Well, I didn't do it. But here again, you know, the guy didn't start off thinking he was going to be a criminal. Didn't think he was going to shoot anybody. But he ended up doing it. And, you know, people say, well, you know, the gun didn't kill him. The guy did. Yeah, but, you know, had the gun not been there, it'd have been a little more difficult. If he'd have pointed his finger and said, bang, that would have been a little more difficult. Maybe a heart attack, who knows, you know, a fist fight, you know, whatever, you have a chance. So when I come and I look at this scenario, I go, okay, well, these high-capacity magazines make no sense to me. If you're talking about home protection, if you're talking about, you know, hunting, sorry, you've lost me. Because, you know, in the people that I've talked to are quote-unquote experts on the gun issue, if you want to protect your home, the best possible thing that you can get is a shotgun, one that makes a lot of noise when you make that chink, that noise, so that the person on the other side goes, uh-oh, time to go. If that's your true purpose. I know people who have arsenals because they have this thought in their mind that the tyrannical government's coming for them and they're going to stockpile. And, all right, you know, God bless you. But what is that going to do if someone does break in and steal them, as has happened? In this case, the kid in Connecticut. And look, I'm not sold on either side. I'm actually pretty well in the middle. because I do believe people should have the right to protect themselves. I think they should have the right if they choose, and that they're responsible to own a gun. I'm right there. I'm with you. But I think, as Irwin pointed out, this concept that we're going to overthrow the tyrannical government, it ain't happening. That ship sailed. This idea that the government's going to come and take all of our guns, that ain't happening either. Sorry, not happening. That's a paranoid worldview. But what I do keep seeing, almost with great regularity here recently, and a lot of it I think has to do with our media, is I see these people who have some mental health problems, who have access to these things, doing some pretty deadly stuff. And this thing with these kids, I've got two kids in elementary school right now. And I remember when the shooting happened. I mean, I'm fortunate they're here with me now. And I think every parent felt that. And I don't bring that up to pull heartstrings. Let's give all of our guns. No, that's not it. It's about having a discussion of what's rational. I don't understand extremism. This, that there's no middle ground. Because I think Irwin pointed it out. We've given up the ability to have, howitzers, and we've given up the ability to have, armored tanks and cruise missiles. We've given that up already. And I agree with the executive order thing. I don't know that I'm comfortable with. But I haven't seen what they're doing yet. I haven't seen what it is. So by saying, you can't do it, there are a lot of things you can't do by executive order. But there are some things you can do. So before I get all riled up, I want to see what it is. Because the right is doing a pretty masterful job of doing the bidding of the NRA to get people all wound up. And the more I see this, the more I kind of take a step back, take a breath. Because I think we all agree we want to keep our kids safe. And the best way to keep our kids safe, sorry, not putting a cop in every classroom. We want to be able to go to a movie theater and not get shot up. And I don't think having a cop in every theater is, it's not going to happen. So we've got to have that conversation. Going to take a quick break, back with hour two of the program. If you missed any portion of the first hour, therickssmithshow.com. You can download the podcast. You get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Right back after that.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIND, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A potential class action lawsuit could determine how responsible companies need to be when it comes to third-party contract labor. Jesse Russell reports.
A federal judge has ruled that Walmart can be included in a class action lawsuit filed by workers for a contract warehouse. The Inland Empire, California warehouse is operated by Schneider Logistics, and the employees have targeted the company with allegations of wage theft. While Walmart doesn't directly own the warehouse, the workers argue that the company has ultimate say over how the workers are treated and could apply pressure to ensure they're treated right by contractors. The world's largest retailer has argued that the workers aren't employed by the company, but Walmart is still taking the concern seriously. Walmart is putting in place auditors to inspect contractors in the United States. The case could determine how involved major corporations who rely heavily on contract labor are responsible for how workers hired by their contractors are treated.
The Labor Combat Organizing College's mission is to increase the number of non- and anti-union company signatories to union construction jobs and to do it without going through the National Labor Relations Board. Danny Caliendo is the Labor Combat College's lead instructor. Labor Combat uses tactics and technology to train organizers, primarily in the building trades. Caliendo says that the Labor Combat College's tactics are designed to be highly effective in so-called right-to-work states to fight for better wages and benefits for building trades workers.
The day you stop fighting for your rights to have a living wage and to have a good benefit and so on and so forth, the day you're going to die. And we've been dying slowly, unfortunately, for the better part of 3 decades, and 24 right-to-work states kind of emphasize that fact. We've had 102 people through the program since May. They have a money-back offer. They don't like what they hear. They think it's BS. Don't pay us. We haven't not had a check given to us yet.
The International Association of Machinists is at GKN Aerospace in Amityville, New York today, campaigning for support from the workers in a union representation election to be held Friday, January 11th. The IAM says the company has hired union-busting consultants to wage a relentless anti-union campaign. The union says two pro-union workers were fired just before Christmas. The IAM has contracts with GKN Aerospace facilities like in St. Louis, where the union workers make about $5 an hour more and pay 30 to 40% less for their health care. This newscast, made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers, the OPEIU, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
As to what to do for the housing industry specifically, and are the things that you can do to encourage housing, one is don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it run its course and hit the bottom, allow investors to buy homes, put renters in them, fix the homes up, and let it turn around and come back up. The Obama administration has slow walked the foreclosure processes that have long existed, and as a result, we still have a foreclosure over.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, that guy could have been president. Boy, wouldn't that be scary? I mean, his solution to our housing crisis, screw them. Let them lose their houses. We can swap them up dirt cheap, have investors buy them, and then rent them back to the same poor schlub who lost the house in the first place. Good business solution. Yeah. I look at this story from a Swiss court, and this just blows my mind. A Swiss court evidently wiped away a claim by the Catholic Church dating back to 1357. Evidently, this guy named Conrad Mueller killed this guy, Henry Stuckey, back in 1357. And in order to save his soul and avoid being attacked by the family, he gave the church this lamp and promised to pay the fuel costs for eternity. Well, it turns out that they wanted to get that in writing now. Another part of this is the church would have gotten the family's land if they didn't pay the $76 a year for the oil. I love that. For eternity, they've got a claim on that land. Kind of like our mortgage industry. Interesting stuff. Anyway, last night we talked about the big settlements. I wanted to talk a little bit about that and also what we should be doing, which is why I've asked Julia Gordon, Director of Housing, Finance, and Public Policy at American Progress. She works on stabilizing the housing market, shaping the future of housing finance and other housing-related policies. Going to help us work through some of this. Julia, thanks for taking time for me. Julia, you there?
I'm here.
Thanks for taking time for me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, last night we talked about the big settlement, the $8.5 billion, which, you know, it's a big number. I don't know that it's going to do much. But I went home last night and I saw you on C-SPAN talking about the exact same thing that we talked about on the program last night, which is using eminent domain to get some of these houses from these banks and turning this problem around.
That's right. We were on C-SPAN with a panel about that yesterday, because what has been missing in this whole foreclosure crisis is any control over the situation by anybody but the banks.
Right.
Homeowners have had no control over it, and municipalities have had no control over it. So, you know, homeowners have to sit there while their, you know, lenders don't take their phone calls. And, you know, local governments sit there while their tax base goes down the drain, right?
Yep, and that's what we've seen happen to communities across the country. So the question then becomes, and I love the idea of using eminent domain. The more I think about it, I don't think you'd have to use it but a couple of times, and the banks would go, uh-oh, we better do something. So I think as the stick, I think it would be a great idea.
You know, that's what you need as a stick. What's been missing from the entire response over the past 5 years is any kind of stick. It's all been about carrots. It's all, pretty please, mortgage lenders, won't you help us out? Well, they're the folks who got us here to begin with. So why we expect they're the ones with an incentive to get us out of it is not clear to me.
Yep.
And, you know, some years back, what some folks in Congress tried to do is make sure that people could fix this problem through the bankruptcy courts, which is, frankly, the system we have in this country that is supposed to deal with debt problems, right? This is a debt problem. But no, the banks didn't want that to happen. They felt too exposed. And that was another situation where you wouldn't have had to have everybody go through bankruptcy. You just would have needed the banks to know that that was a possibility, right?
Absolutely.
So that's the same thing with the eminent domain idea.
Because, you know, right when the collapse happened, you know, the first thing that I said has to happen is we have to get people refinancing their loans at current market value. Somebody's got to take a haircut. A lot of this had to do with the banks. It was their deal. They made this happen. They're going to have to share in the pain as well. And here we are years later still. I've yet to see any of that write down. I've yet to see any of that happen.
Yeah, they share in very little of the pain. I mean, I don't know if you talked about this last night when you talked about the settlement, but what was ironic was prior to the settlement, when some of the federal regulators, you know, the ones who fell down on the job to begin with, tried to make it right after they looked into this and saw what a poor job the mortgage servicers had been doing. You know, they said, well, we need to review people's loan files and see where you made mistakes. Well, it turned out they paid the consultants to look at the files more than they were paying the consumers whose files had mistakes in them.
Yep. Yeah, we talked about it, and I guess it doesn't surprise me, because you end up with these consultants, they just want to make money, and there's no cop on the beat, there's no oversight, and there's really no stick there to beat people back from doing it.
Right. It's really important that we put some control back into the hands of the victims of this entire crisis.
So the $8.5 billion, is that anything? Because I look at it and go, if they agreed to $8.5 billion, if these 10 banks agreed to $8.5 billion, how much did they walk away with?
You know, they walked away with a lot. $8.5 billion is not zero, right? It's better than zero. Some people will get some money, and that's a good thing. Will any of these settlements begin to touch repairing the damage that's been done out there? Absolutely not. I mean, you can think of it this way. Imagine you have a very big oil spill. Sure, you can try to clean it up afterward and you know, you wipe off the birds and all of that. But the fact is, you can never put that oil back in the tanker.
Right.
That environment's never going to be like it is again. The damage that's been done to American neighborhoods is severe. In some neighborhoods, they may never come back. And, you know, a few thousand dollars to a homeowner here and there is not going to change that.
So let me ask you a couple of quick questions. I mean, you know, how do we stop any of the future unnecessary foreclosures? I've heard some horror stories of people saying, well, you know what, we agreed to a modification, then a week later they came and they threw all of our stuff out. Or, you know, there's just hundreds of thousands of these stories. How do we stop those things from happening to people?
What we need is strong rules going forward that the mortgage servicers, those are the folks who collect your money and whose job it is to work with you if you need help, those folks have to have rules of the road, and the rules have to be enforceable by the homeowners themselves. It can't just be, well, let's rely on the regulators or let's rely on the attorneys general. Even, let's assume all those folks are trying to do the right thing. They've got limited resources. There's a lot more of homeowners than there are of them.
Right. We've outprocreated them.
You know, individual homeowners has to have some way to fight back, to say you didn't do what you said you were going to do, and, you know, whether it's to take them to court or, you know, some other kind of redress. And when we're talking, you know, just to go back to the eminent domain issue, we have municipalities here who are hurting badly, and there's nothing they can do right now under current law about it. So how do they try to rebuild their own economies? How do they make sure more of their folks don't go into foreclosure? Because, you know, the thing about foreclosures is it's a downward spiral. You have foreclosures that causes the home values of the nearby homes to drop. When people's homes are worth less, they are more likely to enter foreclosure if they encounter any kind of problem in their life, you know, lose a job or, you know, someone dies or you get a divorce.
Or just wake up and realize I paid $300,000 for a house that's worth
$200,000. Well, yeah, that's a whole different question is, you know, people walking away from their homes. You know, the banks like to talk about these mortgages being this sacred moral obligation, but they don't treat them that way, right?
Absolutely not. And I look at this and I go, you know, and, you know, stopping these foreclosures and making those banks turn over those houses that have been foreclosed on, have been sitting vacant for months, if not years. And I look at I saw a story about my hometown of Cleveland where they finally were just taking these houses and bulldozing them because they had been vacant for so long. People had ripped all the copper and all the wires.
Well, in some places, that's what you have to do with vacant homes. And that's why the most important thing to do, the most effective and economically efficient thing to do is to prevent someone from losing their home in the first place. And that's why we need to help homeowners who owe more on their mortgages than their home is worth.
How do we help them?
So eminent domain is one way to help them, especially those folks whose loans are bundled up in these private securities, and really nobody has any way of getting into those private securities. So, you know, eminent domain would be a power that is, you know, already frequently used by local governments, of course.
Right.
And it would be using that power to take the mortgages out of these pools and restructure them so that they're essentially right-sized.
Right. So walk me through how this would happen. Let's say my town wanted to say, you know, this house, which is a house in our neighborhood, has been vacant for a year and a half now. It's foreclosed on. What would they do?
So the very most basic explanation of how this works is the municipality condemns the mortgage, not the home. This isn't like taking your home away so we can build a highway. It's just taking the mortgage, you know, the note that's held by the person you owe the money to, you know, when you buy the house.
Right.
And the municipality pays the you know, the pool of mortgages or the investors who have that mortgage now. They pay them fair value for that. It's not that they take it without paying for it. They pay for it, they take it, and then they essentially now own your mortgage, and they do the right thing with the mortgage, which is restructure it so that you're more likely to be able to stay in that home and continue to pay off that mortgage over time as opposed to defaulting on it.
So basically, if you got somebody who's, you know, they're going to lose their home, there's a possibility of refinancing it and basically selling it back to them with them ever having to leave the house.
Right, it's not even selling it back. You're not even taking it away from them. From the homeowner's perspective, nothing changes except they have someone who they owe the mortgage money to, who instead of not caring about them and not being able to help them, has a very strong and vested interest in helping them, because your local municipality cares whether or not you stay in that house. It's good
taxes
for the municipality for you to stay in that house in that neighborhood.
Yeah, because you're going to pay taxes to the municipality, you're going to pay school taxes, you're going to be stable in the community.
Exactly. You know, you won't have to close your schools and pay more for fire services and police.
Because I look at this and I see this as, if you did it once, I think it's that stick that they go, we might see a lot of this. We better do something in a hurry.
You know, they're already responding to it. Certainly the investors have organized against this, and you've seen other, you've seen the Federal Housing Finance Agency put in their two cents that, that this makes them very nervous. And, you know, let me be fair, it's not easy to figure out exactly how to do this. We haven't done it before, and there are lots of permutations of how you could do it. And, you know, some of those permutations might, in practice, work better or be more fair than others. But the basic idea is pretty clear.
Now, someone had brought up, when I had gotten an email when I talked about this yesterday, they brought up the Connecticut situation up in, it was near Putnam, up near Norwich,
right.
Where the city wanted to take the land to build, I think it was a whole bunch of high-density living area, if I remember right.
Right, right.
And they took, is this similar to that?
So the power of eminent domain is the common thread, but this is a little bit different. You know, over the course of history, eminent domain has been used for, whether you call it urban renewal or gentrification or whatever, the power has been used to take land often from poor communities, from communities of color, and to try to use it in some way that the interest and power find more attractive, right? And so, you know, like any power of government, the power can be used for good or for bad.
Right.
But it's a very commonly used power. You know, the eminent domain is used all the time to build a new road or, you know, do something that's necessary for just reasons of development. So this is just repurposing it,
to benefit people.
To benefit the community. You need to have a public purpose. It needs to serve the public good.
Which is why when I was thinking about it, which is why I thought it's never going to happen. Because it's going to benefit people at the bottom, working class folks. Which is why this, in my opinion, and you don't have to go along with it, which is why I think this probably wouldn't work that way.
You know, but that's, I think, what's complicated about this idea and why some advocates who have otherwise been working very hard on foreclosure prevention efforts aren't sure about this particular proposal, because some of the proposals on the table right now involve private investors using their money to help the municipality buy these mortgages and then refinance them, and the private investors stand to turn a profit off of it. And, of course, that makes folks nervous.
Well, I mean, just like Romney said at the clip in coming into this segment, you know, basically we're just going to have investors come in, buy up all those mortgages, and we will rent them out for a tidy little profit.
Well, of course, that's what's happening. These mortgages go through foreclosure. All this inventory out there, I'll tell you, those vacant homes you see, those are the vacant ones because they're in terrible shape. The pipes have been torn out. There was a meth lab in the basement, whatever it was. Houses that are in good shape, those are in short supply. Those are being snapped up for cash by investors all over the place. And so, interestingly, what you're going to see is essentially the same interest that crashed the housing market into the ditch to begin with. Now they're going to buy low and sell high.
Yeah. Let me ask you a last question. Are we then creating another bubble like we did the last time?
We may be. I mean, you know, we see the housing market recovering now. We see prices coming back. But the question is, are the fundamentals really there, or is this more about a lot of investors trying to get in on a good thing?
Interesting. Julia Gordon, I appreciate the time, and thanks for the information. I appreciate it.
A pleasure to talk with you.
Director of Housing Finance at American Progress. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Cares about the deficit. We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year. If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Good news, America. At last, scientists are grappling with a persistent affliction that can strike without warning, causing anxiety for millions of families every year. It's the tragedy of needle drop. No, not drug injection needles. Christmas tree needles. Each December, you search out the finest and freshest conifer, pay good money for it, give it water and love, decorate it beautifully, and how does it repay you? Within 2 to 4 weeks, the ingrate is shedding needles over your carpet. It's the scourge of Christmas, I tell you. But take heart, for your tax-funded land-grant colleges are on the way to rescue you and all other needle drop sufferers. Specifically, plant pathologists at Washington State University, North Carolina State, and elsewhere have mounted a $1.3 million RNA sequencing trial. They're sampling branches from thousands of trees in search of that one nucleotide polymorphism that controls needle drop. This heroic mission requires remarkable attention to detail. For example, in Puyallup, Washington, a research specialist lifts each of several thousand sample branches in her lab one by one, rubs her fingers up and down each stem, then counts the needles that fall from each one. Another specialist enters the number into an ever-spreading spreadsheet. It's a tedious job, but someone has to do it. Or not. Really, of all the problems facing American consumers and agriculture, should Christmas needle retention be this high on our list of research priorities? Well, responds the chief needle drop pathologist at Washington State, the Christmas tree industry is a $1 billion industry. This is Jim Hightower saying, exactly. So let this profitable industry pay for its own research, rather than diverting our tax funds and government scientists from more important work that will produce much greater public benefit.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that if the full range of tax increases and spending cuts were allowed to take effect, a scenario widely referred to as the fiscal cliff, a shallow recession would occur early next year.
Just a mirage, that's all you are to me. Just a mirage, the night I only...
Oh, yeah, it would have been the end of the world. Yes, yes, if we would have gone over the grand cliff. And, yeah, look, there were some... Had it actually happened, there would have been some things that would have been negative, but I got to be honest, the whole push towards making the Bush tax cuts permanent, wow. Victory Republicans on that one. Good news, I guess, if you look at it this way, the people at AIG decided, I don't think we're going to sue, probably not a good idea, PR. And I like some of the thoughts that came out as they were, thinking about it, because on one hand, they've got this slew of ads running all over. If you saw, I was watching football on Sunday, man, and it was almost every other ad was AIG saying, you know what, we fixed this and we insured that and, we took all your money. Yeah, but we paid it back. Thank you. And then saying, well, we're going to sue you. So Elizabeth Warren had an interesting statement. She said it would be outrageous for this company to turn around and sue the federal government because they think the deal wasn't generous enough. She said AIG should thank American taxpayers for their help, not bite the hand that feeds them. Bernanke, Geithner, furious over what was going on. The guy who was the former TARP inspector, Neil, what was it, Borofsky, he said that them doing it would be the equivalent of the giant middle finger. And my question was, is it the giant invisible middle finger? Because we keep hearing we need the invisible man to be doing all these things, the invisible hand of the market. Is it the invisible middle finger now that they're giving us, or is this just right out in front of us? Now, what I find interesting is, you know, you got these shareholders who, it just blows my mind how the wealth class of this country believes that they should be entitled to protection from, you know, homeowners, screw you. But, you know, I've got a stock, and, you know, I should be first in line. I'm sacrosanct. So they're going to sue, saying that they didn't get a good enough deal. Understand, AIG was worth nothing. They were done. It was over. And because you and me, we the taxpayers, we said, you know what, we're gonna help them out. We're going to get the screws in this. Because still, the shareholders are going to go through the process of suing us. And I predict we will win, but at what cost? Because there'll probably be a settlement because we don't want to pay all the legal fees and all the wrangling. And so they know that. I mean, we've constantly appeased the wealth class. Constantly. And we've given them so much power. It just blows my mind. And, you know, I've been reading about it because there's a big pension fight coming up here in Pennsylvania. They're gonna try and figure out how they can steal pensions from retirees and how they can screw up the state system even more. And I've been doing a lot of reading about the pension system. And I look back to the 80s and the 90s and all of the nonsense that has gone on and all of the things that the wealthy in this country have gotten away with You want to talk about redistribution of wealth? Every Tea Partier in this country, everyone should read the book, The Retirement Heist. You want to talk about redistribution of wealth? You want to talk about theft? Just out and out theft. You and I have gotten screwed. And I've told the story about the guy I used to know who worked for Lucent Technology, who was one of the big players in this. Cutting off divisions, selling off divisions, overfunding the pension funds of the division going, and of course jacking the price up extremely high so they could pocket the money. I remember that guy who told me, you know, at one point, driving the Cadillac, got the big boat, got the world by the short hairs, hundreds of thousands in his 401k. Turns out his 401k was heavily, heavily invested in what? Oh, that's right, Lucent Technologies. So when it went from 102 bucks a share down to 2 in the blink of an eye, all that evaporated. And then he got cut off because we're outsourcing your job. We're moving that. You're going to lose that. And oh, by the way, if you want that severance package, you're going to have to train your replacement from India. This is what we've allowed them to get away with. And we've allowed these employers, because we need jobs, right? And we need the job creators. We've given them so much control over our economy. We've given these corporations so much control and so much power. And we've allowed them to grow so large that you go, you know, competition? Are you kidding me? You know, the right's screaming about socialism because we feed hungry children. They're worried about socialism because, you know, we help folks who, when they lose their jobs, that they're not going to lose their house right away. We're talking about helping folks when they get sick. So if you have a mild heart attack like my grandmother did, you're not going to lose everything that you own. That's socialism. But making sure that the wealth class is well protected, making sure that their pensions are fully taken care of, because during the great collapse, while you and I were losing our pension money, theirs were guaranteed. Again, they get richer, we get poorer. And guess where that money, that guaranteed money comes from? You know it. It comes from you and me. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
Own 90% of the wealth, 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death, no one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
An asteroid you might not have known to worry about has been given the all clear.
Astronomers thought that this asteroid had the potential to collide with Earth in the year 2040. But data from the Gemini Observatory in Hawaii has shown that this asteroid will not collide with Earth. This asteroid is called 2011 AG5. It's about 140 meters in diameter, about the length of two American football fields.
Astronomers agree that if this object were to collide with the Earth, it would release several thousand times as much energy as the atomic bomb that ended World War II. Statistically, they say a body of this size should impact the Earth on average every 10,000 years. But 2011 AG5 will not hit us in 2040.
Why do we hear so much nowadays about asteroids passing near Earth? The fact is that astronomers are now actively looking for asteroids that come near Earth, and that's why they're finding them. A telescopic survey of the sky, called the Mount Lemmon Survey, found asteroid 2011 AG5. This survey is specifically designed to look for asteroids that pass near Earth.
Astronomers found 2011 AG5 early in the year 2011. They had to observe its orbit long enough to be certain of it, to learn that Earth no longer falls along a possible future path for this asteroid in 2040. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I got a list of demands, written on the palm of my hand. I'm all my sister, you are no right man. Reeling an end, I'm about to want to see somebody try to free somebody. Got a list of
welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, interesting story. Gary Bettman, the commissioner of the NHL, because it appears there will be a puck dropping on the ice this year after all. They have come to an agreement, and the NHL governors have okayed the deal. But Gary Bettman, he's sorry. So sorry. I didn't really mean it. Can we just hold hands, kiss, and make up and be friends? After another lockout. And, you know, it's one of these things that we've seen across professional sports. Increasingly, strikes, something we don't see very often, more lockouts. Which is why I've asked Sarah Jaffe, labor journalist, to come talk about this agreement and really what's going on in professional sports and, jobs across the country. Sarah, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me. Don't we just feel Gary's sincere apology? I mean, he's so sorry, Rick. He's so sorry.
Of course he is. He actually didn't mean it.
Yeah, I can tell how sorry he is from here. Let me tell you.
I can hear the money in his pockets. That's sorry as well. Because
right.
I look at this deal and boy, the workers got screwed.
I mean, it's not as bad as the one a few years ago where they went from getting 74% of hockey-related revenue down to 57, but they did drop from 57 to 50-50 split, which is, I mean, this is the 50-50 split of the money that the owners haven't already taken their cut for, you know, ostensibly costs and whatever else. This is the 50-50 split of the money that they determine is coming just from hockey.
Of what's left over. You get what's left over.
Right.
But, you know, here again, I guess you're right, because originally the owners wanted the players only get 46%.
Right. But, I mean, 50-50, the rumor was that that was what they wanted all along, that that's what they were aiming for. And the 46 was sort of their jerk move negotiating whatever that they threw out this summer. And so, you know, 50-50, probably what they were looking to get all along. I mean, the players are getting a pension program out of this that they didn't have before. They didn't get as wholly screwed as they did in 2004, 2005, I guess is what I'm saying. But it's still not a great deal.
But this is a long-term contract, so maybe because there'll be a season next year?
Well, this is ostensibly 10 years, and either one can opt out after 8. So the best thing that I can think of is that Gary Bettman probably won't be commissioner anymore. But, I mean, they'll probably have somebody equally terrible and equally determined to bust the union then. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, you got to use what's at your disposal to steal from the people who actually create the wealth.
Right, exactly. And, like, here's the thing, right, is that, like, there's not a lot of sympathy out there for rich athletes, right? So, you know, even, bad example. President Obama says, you know, oh, well, we've got a lot of rich people and they just need to sit down and work out a deal. And it's like, no, you've got the world's richest people. You've got guys who are on Forbes' list of billionaires who own these things.
Yep.
A lot of whom are hardcore right-wing ideologues. The guy who owns the Philadelphia Flyers, everybody remembers that he had Sarah Palin come drop the puck to resounding boos back in 2008. Well, he also financed the Atlas Shrugged movie.
Now that I didn't know.
Yeah, Ed Snyder financed the Atlas Shrugged movies.
But here again, I'm not a huge hockey fan, but you know, I look at these things and I go, you know, we've been seeing these lockouts with some regularity, where these, as you pointed out, these billionaires are saying, you know what, that little bit that we're paying you, it's too much. We want more, and more never seems to be enough. They want more than that.
No, exactly.
So, at what point do people like me and fans say, you know what, I'm turned off from it?
I mean, this is the thing, right? I mean, I love the sport. I've always loved the sport. I grew up on the sport. I grew up on the Bruins. You know what? I won't do ever again until Jeremy Jacobs is retired or dead is root for the Bruins, because he's the number one. I mean, he's the Jeremy Jacobs who owns the Bruins is the head of the owners, whatever, and he's the one who keeps pushing for these deals.
He was the last holdout in the last lockout.
He was the ringleader of the hardline faction this time, and I will not cheer for his team. I will not give them my money, because whatever. But I mean, what else can I do? I, you know, do I give up watching the sport? Do I boycott it? I mean, I want these guys to be able to continue to make a pretty good living for however many years they have a career. It's frustrating, right? What do you do? What can you do? This time around, at least, there was sort of an outcry on social media, on the internet, that there wasn't last time, that I think is probably the reason we didn't lose another season.
Good point. But here's what frustrates me, and I just overheard this yesterday at breakfast, where a couple of the cooks at the restaurant were talking about, oh, there's going to be a season. And immediately, it wasn't a lockout in their mind. It was the players were going on strike because they weren't getting enough. And the frame has been, anytime there's a labor dispute, it's automatically the worker's fault. But I look at all of these lockouts, and you got to call a lockout what it is. It's the employer saying, screw you, until you capitulate, until you do what I want you to do, you'll get nothing.
And particularly in these cases, in most of these sports lockouts in recent years, the players are perfectly willing to play under the expired CBA. They're happy to play under the old terms. The owners are like, no. We're going to force you out. There's basically nowhere, you know, a lot of the players have been playing overseas, but they don't make nearly the money and they don't get nearly the attention.
Right.
And so there's really nowhere else I can go. But, yeah, I mean, you have to call a lockout what it is, and you have to note that lockouts are on the rise everywhere.
And not
right?
just in professional
not just sports.
Right.
Right.
As you point out in your article, it's not just professional sports. It's across just about every industry in this country.
Yeah, no, exactly. We are in the age of the lockout because they're working, you know, because the owners are largely getting what they want. In the rare case where it doesn't work and, you know, you have like the American Crystal Sugar workers who are just refusing to take crappy contract after crappy contract, they just keep, you know, holding out, which is wonderful. I wish we saw more of it. But mostly they work, and it's awful. And, God, I wish the players would go on strike. I wish there were more strikes. Right?
I wish there were. I wish people would say enough already. I've had enough. You've used this crisis. You've used the Bush recession long enough to screw me out of wages and benefits and ruin conditions. Enough is enough. And, there's a saying, there's only so much of you know what people are can eat. How much more can people eat?
Yeah, I mean, really. And this is why I think it's important to talk about these sports lockouts, right, is that if you are breaking, getting, wringing concessions out of some of the most talented, most recognizable names in the sport in the world, then look at what happens to everyday people.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, you look at this, and, you know, it's an interesting way of framing it, but generally the people at the top of the game, they're not the ones getting screwed. It's the people in the middle towards the bottom. Everybody at the bottom, they're the ones who end up getting the screws in this. They're the ones who play 2 or 3 years, and then are banged up for the rest of their life and have nothing from it. I don't have a problem with professional athletes making big money because they have such short careers.
Oh yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, right? Is it, yeah, exactly. It's not, you know, Sidney Crosby apparently wanted to make a compromise. Well, you know what? Like, Sidney Crosby's gonna be fine.
Yeah.
He's rich. You know, it's these, and this was an interesting thing too, is one of the things that they were pushing for, that the owners were pushing for was an end to these sort of ridiculous long-term contracts that they signed somebody to, you know, a 13-year contract at however many million dollars. But they were signing them all over the summer. They were throwing money at people, the same owners who then turned around. Like, there's an article on Sports Illustrated, I believe, about the contracts that the Bruins signed and that Jeremy Jacobs clearly had no intention of ever paying. And it's just like, how is that, you know, on what planet is that acceptable? That you sign somebody to a, you know, 13-year, however many million dollar deal that you're then going to go into the bargaining table and take away from them anyway.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the Bruins, never have been, never a big fan of the big city teams. I, as a kid growing up, my favorite NHL hockey team you've never heard of, the Cleveland Barons. They existed for exactly 2 seasons in the mid-70s. But here again, you know, they tried to expand, and the smaller markets couldn't make it. And we're seeing kind of the exact same thing right now. You saw an expansion into places like Arizona, where they don't even have ice.
They don't even have ice. No. Well, yeah, Arizona, there's 2 teams in Florida, there's 3 in California. You know, there was one in Atlanta that didn't even last. They are now the Winnipeg Jets again, Carolina. And, like, even when these teams are good teams, even when Carolina and Tampa Bay won the Stanley Cup, they're still not making the money that, like, the, you know, Toronto Maple Leafs are making, that the Rangers are making, that, you know, the Bruins are making. They're just not doing it. It's going to take years for them to do so. And if they, you know, and the expansion into all these places was Gary Bettman's brainchild. And if he wanted to do it, then the way to actually do that would be to have a revenue sharing plan wherein you're actually subsidizing these teams so they have a chance to exist.
No, see, it's much easier. It's much easier to screw the workers and steal from them.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly. And that's literally what happened here, right? Is that, like, the big money guys didn't want to share any money. They'd rather take it out of their players' pockets. And so everybody's getting squeezed down to the lowest common denominator so that we can keep a hockey team in Phoenix that is in bankruptcy.
Yeah, I remember the story about the Arizona team where the city said we can't pay it anymore. And they gave hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies and all kind of stuff. And the taxpayers end up getting screwed on that too. So again, the people at the bottom, the people buying the tickets, screwed.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what we do. And, you know, Gary Bettman cares about you. He's not going to lower ticket prices or anything, but he cares.
So
I mean, we just have to take for granted that he cares because he's certainly not going to do anything to show us that he cares.
Well, he said he was sorry. Come on, sir. He said he was sorry.
I, white man's tears.
Oh. So last question then. When does the big season start? How long is it going to be? Are we going to have a big cup at the end?
So they were insisting that they would not have a season that was less than 48 games. So there will be, I assume, 48 games. They have not released a schedule yet. The players have yet to ratify the deal, but everybody's assuming that they will. So there will theoretically be 48 games. There will be playoffs. There will be all of that. But, you know, it's going to be depressing to be the team that wins the Stanley Cup this year.
Because you're going to have one of the asterisks next to your name.
Yeah, I mean, you know, after a shortened season and whatever, and you're, you know, some of your guys haven't been playing at all, some of them have been playing overseas, you know, who knows? It's just going to be, I have no idea. But
so are you,
tell you what, I want to go to a game. I'm sorry, I'm still a fan.
Yeah, me too. That's why we go to the Hershey Bears games. That's why we go
to there you go. Yeah, there you go.
We do that. Sarah, I appreciate the time. The article, Why the NHL Lockout Problem So Much Worse Than Any Other Leagues, written by Sarah Jaffe. We've got a link at the RickSmithShow.com. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a quick break. Back right after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at ganleylaw.com.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high-interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
The headline over at Fake News on Fox, Union Thugs Burn House of Worship. They caught them. Yeah, did you know they caught the union? No, they didn't. Some police police detective, one of the, I think it was a lieutenant or so-and-so, said, well, you know, I think, you know, I kind of think that, you know, there was somebody who went over there, and, well, let's blame them, because they're the easy target. And we see this all the time. And like I said, you know, yesterday morning we were at breakfast, and the cooks are talking about, oh, those players went on strike. No, they were locked out. But our media, you know, screw those workers. Point the finger at them. You know what I would have liked to have seen? And let me ask you, what would have happened? What would have happened had the headline been non-union contractor burns down building because he couldn't afford to finish it? Because, you know, hey, the reporter would have asked me. I'd say, well, you know, hey, could it be possibly that they underbid the contract, they underbid the building, you know, because competition's tough. So they underbid it, and then they couldn't finish it. So they go, well, you know, we can't finish it. We're going to get sued. Let's burn it down. Try again. You'd never see that headline, would you? But it's perfectly okay for fake news on Fox, evidently in our media culture, to have the headline, those union thugs burned down the house of worship. Oh, they did it. No proof. And I read the article a couple of weeks. This happened back in December. It's perfectly okay for the police chief. Evidently in our culture, it's perfectly okay for a police official to point the finger without any evidence, without anyone, without any inkling of evidence. And that's what drives me nuts about our drive-by media, if you want to use the right-wing frame, because all they did here is, well, he said it, he said. If it were me, if I were the labor, well, who are you going to sue? Well, who would be the person to take care of it? Because what they've done here is they haven't said it exactly what union. It wasn't though that specific union. It was unions in general. And this is all part of that no rights at work agenda that the right is pushing, because you have to demonize those unions. And why? Because the wealth class understands the only way that you and I are going to get a fair shake, the only way you and I are going to get a fair slice of what we create. And I look at what went on in the NHL in this lockout. Imagine if those players, those workers, imagine if they didn't have a labor contract. Imagine if they weren't members of a union. What could they then do? Well, nothing, actually. It would be imposed upon them. Some of the wealthier players could sue, maybe, possibly. But without the contract, without the collective, if you will, without the union, it's imposed. It happens. Which is why there has to be this whole campaign to demonize unions. So when fake news on Fox throws it out there, union thugs burn house of worship, who's going to hold them accountable? There's no specific union that they're targeting. Because my first thought was, well, you know, someone should sue them. Because it's BS. If you can't prove it, shut up. Whatever happened to innocent until proven? Oh, not exactly, unless you're a union. Or the union. And we hear the same thing the right does with the government. And the point is you demonize without really understanding that the government is you and me and my kids and all of us together. It's our government. It's not the government. It's ours. And the union, like it's some outside entity, is, well, it's those workers. It's all of those people. People. Now, we don't see, the right doesn't seem to have a problem with their love and adoration of corporations, which is just a collection of money. But when it comes to you and me saying, you know what, we're going to try and stand up against those corporations, against the wealth class, well, evidently, that's a bit too much. And, you know, I've kind of, you know, when it comes to the professional sports stuff, these owners have just, they've really kind of ruined it. I mean, for me, especially with hockey. Hockey was one of those sports the last couple of years. Are they going to have a season? Are they not? And I'm glad to see that they have a longer-term agreement. But at some point, you just, you know, go, you know what? I don't know. It's angering and it's frustrating. But I look at it this way. And I don't have, I've never had a problem with the players being paid. You know, I hear some people, oh, they're millionaires. Of course. You know, they're making hopefully a fair share of the profits, even though we've been seeing over the last several years in every major sport where the owners are saying, we want more. We want more of the take and more and more and more. But haven't we been seeing the exact same thing in the workforce as a whole? The problem is that these are really high profile. And most people who punch a clock, most people who go to work, they don't have the luxury of a contract. They don't have the luxury of having someone to help represent them. They don't have the ability to come together collectively and say, you know what, there's so much of it we won't eat. And I'm waiting for that moment. Because what we've seen the last couple of years since the Bush recession, what we've seen go on, this theft of wages, this theft of benefits, what we're seeing right before our eyes, and I got to be honest with you, this all of the Wendy's and all of the Darden restaurants, the Olive Gardens and the Red Lobsters and all of the Denny's and all of these restaurant franchises who are saying, well, we're cutting our workers' hours. We're cutting it way back so we don't have to pay Obamacare. I hope people wake up and go, you know what? Not eating it anymore. There's only so much of you-know-what people are going to eat. And I'm hoping at some point people go, you know what? I've had enough of it rammed down my throat. And we come together and say, you know what? There's got to be a better way. And then we look to the past as a model. Maybe we come up with a different model that empowers workers, that empowers people to be able to share in the wealth that they create. Maybe there is. But it's going to take us to stand up and say no more to the upper ups, no more to the billionaire class. And, you know, I was listening to one of the talking heads on the way in. And, well, the left hates billionaires. I don't hate them. I hate what they're doing. Because once they get to a point of power, they only want more. Once they get to the position of wealth, they only want more. And they have the power and the ability to get it. Quick break back with Hour 3. I know
your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A potential class action lawsuit could determine how responsible companies need to be when it comes to third-party contract labor. Jesse Russell reports.
A federal judge has ruled that Walmart can be included in a class action lawsuit filed by workers for a contract warehouse. The Inland Empire, California warehouse is operated by Schneider Logistics, and the employees have targeted the company with allegations of wage theft. While Walmart doesn't directly own the warehouse, the workers argue that the company has ultimate say over how the workers are treated and could apply pressure to ensure they're treated right by contractors. The world's largest retailer has argued that the workers aren't employed by the company, but Walmart is still taking the concern seriously. Walmart is putting in place auditors to inspect contractors in the United States. The case could determine how involved major corporations who rely heavily on contract labor are responsible for how workers hired by their contractors are treated.
The Labor Combat Organizing College's mission is to increase the number of non- and anti-union company signatories to union construction jobs and to do it without going through the National Labor Relations Board. Danny Caliendo is the Labor Combat College's lead instructor. Labor Combat uses tactics and technology to train organizers, primarily in the building trades. Caliendo says that the Labor Combat College's tactics are designed to be highly effective in so-called right-to-work states to fight for better wages and benefits for building trades workers.
The day you stop fighting for your rights to have a living wage and to have a good benefit and so on and so forth, the day you're going to die. And we've been dying slowly, unfortunately, for the better part of 3 decades, and 24 right-to-work states kind of emphasize that fact. We've had 102 people through the program since May. They have a money-back offer. They don't like what they hear. They think it's BS. Don't pay us. We haven't not had a check given to us yet.
The International Association of Machinists is at GKN Aerospace in Amityville, New York today, campaigning for support from the workers in the union representation election to be held Friday, January 11th. The IAM says the company has hired union-busting consultants to wage a relentless anti-union campaign. The union says two pro-union workers were fired just before Christmas. The IAM has contracts with GKN Aerospace facilities like in St. Louis, where the union workers make about $5 an hour more and pay 30 to 40% less for their health care. This newscast, made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers, the OPEIU, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast from the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. For the last several months, we've been talking about the toll group port drivers out in Los Angeles organizing, saying, you know what, enough. We want a little bit. We want to be able to, support our families. We'd like to have a little health care, maybe a little pension, maybe a little something, a little future. And, you know, I look at this as a model of, hey, we should be organizing all truck drivers. And as someone who drove a truck for years myself, what we're doing to these owner operators and these independent contractors is a damn shame. We have made that job sweatshop on wheels, which is why I was happy to see that the toll group drivers, have gotten their first contract out in the ports in L.A., which is why I've asked Coral Itzcalli to come out and talk to us. She's a spokesman for the Teamsters to come talk to us about this. Coral, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you so much for having us.
How long had this gone on? I mean, we've been talking about this on the program for it's several months now. How long has this been going on?
The struggle for the toll drivers has been going on for about 2 years. You know, 2 years of them, you know, arming themselves with a lot of courage. It took a lot of courage with what these men and women have done and really standing up to their boss and saying, you know what, we are American workers. We deserve better. We move this economy. We deserve better. We should have, you know, basic things at the workplace like potable drinking water or clean bathrooms. And on top of that, we also want a living wage. And that is exactly what they got with this first-time contract with the Teamsters.
So by them banding together and saying, hey, we're gonna become Teamsters, we want a contract, they've fought, they've won the contract, what kind of benefits, what kind of advancements, what'd they get here?
Huge. I mean, for starters, they have a secure retirement, something that's unheard of for port truck drivers nationwide. They have affordable health care for themselves and their families. They have stable work hours. They also have paid time off, paid sick leave, paid vacation, paid holidays, paid personal days. And they received a jaw-dropping wage increase of $6 more per hour.
Wow.
It is huge. I mean, they went from about $12 to $13 an hour to 19 to 1975 an hour, plus a guaranteed increase every year of the life of that contract. So, I mean, these workers have literally fought for the American dream, and they finally have the American dream within their reach.
You know, I hear that, and I go, you know, all these years, how badly underpaid they've been. And I think about that for most people that I know who are working without a contract and without a union. And you go, hey, an idea in your head, maybe?
Well, you know, this is without a doubt a huge victory for truck drivers, as well as the workers in every industry where hardworking men and women are subject to backbreaking work for meager wages. I mean, these are the poverty wages that for decades have plagued our nation ports, and this is exactly what workers at Walmart, at fast food establishments, at the warehouses, this is exactly what they're fighting against. And, you know, the toll drivers have proven that if workers stick together, they can triumph over any company, no matter how big, how rich, or powerful it is. And more importantly, the drivers at toll have laid out a game plan for the thousands of drivers at the ports nationwide who are ready to also fight for those middle-class wages and finally see their hard professional work valued.
Yeah, the Toll Group, as I understand, a huge multinational corporation.
Right, absolutely. Worldwide, it has operations in over 55 countries worldwide. And so it is a huge company, and it has stepped up to the plate. And Teamsters are very glad to be working with Toll and raising the bar for what American workers, American truck drivers deserve.
See, I look at this, and this is, you want to talk about how to turn our economy around, how to get the economy going in the right direction. This is a step in the right direction, getting people who are working for a living, the people who will move our goods, the people who clean our streets and do all of the jobs that are in this country, actually having a living, decent wage where they could actually, you know, pay for rent, maybe take the family on a vacation, maybe, oh, I don't know, have some disposable income to put back in the economy.
Absolutely. I mean, I spoke to one of the toll drivers this morning, and he was telling me that he already went to the dentist and he got braces for two of his daughters. I mean, already you see money going back into the economy. You see them taking advantage of a healthcare plan that up to now was just not within their reach. And, I mean, it's something so basic as having the healthcare protection for your family, for your children, and, you know, being able to get, like, basic dental work for your kids. I mean, this is what we're talking about for these working families. This is what has been denied to them for decades, and they have finally said enough. And we are celebrating here at the ports. I mean, I can tell you that the energy and excitement on the ground is palpable. Drivers from the West Coast ports all the way to the East Coast ports are talking about this victory, and they want to know how they can be next.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm looking forward to it because, you know, I remember a time, you know, my grandfather was a truck driver. I drove for years, and you know, you go back through the years and you remember when it was a solid middle class job. And it didn't become a solid middle class job without the Teamsters, without people saying, you know what, we're gonna make this, we're gonna drag people kicking and screaming into it, we're gonna make this a living wage job that you can support a family on. And to me, this is a good start.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a turning point for ports nationwide. This is exactly what the labor movement looks like. This is ordinary American workers standing up for what is right and bringing that American dream within the reach of working families. And the Teamsters have been there with port drivers since the beginning. They will continue to be there to the end. Teamsters are very excited and welcome the toll group drivers, you know, with open arms, and can't wait to keep on fighting the good fight.
Yeah, you know, I remember talking to a couple of the drivers over the past several months, and the one guy, it stuck in my head because he was talking about the equipment that they were using and how, you know, there was, you know, the fumes, the diesel fumes were in the cab constantly, and he was having headaches. Is there any language in there about health and safety, anything that's going to help him out? Because I remember he was very adamant, you know, there's no water for us to drink, we can't go to the bathroom anywhere, and I've got to sit and eat my lunch in this truck that has got the fumes sitting with me.
Absolutely. And see, that's the thing. The Teamsters have been part of a groundbreaking campaign to clean up the ports. And by clean up the ports, we're not talking about just replacing old, dirty, diesel-fueling trucks with new, clean trucks. But we're also talking about cleaning up the economical mess that the industry has done to our communities. And so We're part of a national blue-green alliance that has fought to replace all the dirty trucks at the port with clean-burning trucks, and we have that now. So truck drivers at Coal Group are driving clean trucks, not those that are spewing those diesel fumes that you're talking about that did cause headaches and vomiting for truck drivers throughout their work day. So they're driving clean trucks, and they're making a good living doing that. And so not only are we providing, you know, good jobs, we're providing good green jobs.
The website cleanandsafeports.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Click on Coral's name. It'll take you right there. So now that you have this victory, which is a great victory, from this point, it's about growing it. It's about all of the drivers and doing this work across the country now enjoying these benefits. Because I look at this, and this is something that you can take across the country and say, look, this is, because I remember when I was doing organizing, and I was trying to talk to truck drivers saying, you know, this is my paycheck. This is what I get. This is what you could get too. This is what we should be doing across the country. What's the next step from here?
You know, we are already receiving calls. We have been receiving calls even before the news officially got out from truck drivers from various ports knocking on the Teamsters door and wanting to know how to be next. Obviously, Teamsters are very committed to helping and supporting port truck drivers nationwide. And the next step is to continue organizing the workers who are ready to become union, who are ready to fight for their rights, who are ready to end this scam that companies call the independent contractor, that they're not independent in any shape or form, and all it is a lease scam to take money away from these workers and pass on the business costs to these individual workers. And so workers are ready to do that. They're tired of these companies who are tax cheating, who are not paying their fair share of taxes, and who are passing on the business costs to the little guy. And so we're definitely going to keep working on that.
You bring up an excellent something we've talked about a number of times. And, you know, you look at the abuses of the independent contractor and these lease scams, as you've pointed out, where they're basically just cheating the workers. They're not paying unemployment. They're not paying workers' comp. They're not paying anything. These people are just off on their own. And to me, it highlights our broken labor law and what we need to be doing on the legal side of things to be changing our labor laws, redefining who workers are so that they have the ability to join and form unions and to share, much like what these toll drivers have gotten.
Yeah, and also for businesses. I mean, businesses that are responsible, like Toll Group now, you know, that are paying by the rules, that are employing their drivers and calling them employees and not just giving them a 1099 at the end of the year, they need to be able to compete in the market in a fair way. They need to not having to compete with some shady company that is misclassifying their workers.
I mean, for me, I want companies to compete. I want people to compete on service and quality, not on who's willing to slit each other's throats for pennies.
Absolutely. Not on who pays our American workers the least.
Yeah, good point. Well, congratulations on the victory. I'm sure sweet victory it is. 2 years in the making. I appreciate the time, Coral.
Thank you, Rick.
Again, the website, cleanandsafeports.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Coral. It's Callie's name. Take you right there. Quick break. Back after this. Stick around.
America for the better.
Are you feeling that back to school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year. If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Good news, America. At last, scientists are grappling with a persistent affliction that can strike without warning, causing anxiety for millions of families every year. It's the tragedy of needle drop. No, not drug injection needles. Christmas tree needles. Each December, you search out the finest and freshest conifer, pay good money for it, give it water and love, decorate it beautifully, and how does it repay you? Within 2 to 4 weeks, the ingrate is shedding needles all over your carpet. It's the scourge of Christmas, I tell you. But take heart, for your tax-funded land-grant colleges are on the way to rescue you and all other needle-drop sufferers. Specifically, plant pathologists at Washington State University, North Carolina State, and elsewhere have mounted a $1.3 million RNA sequencing trial. They're sampling branches from thousands of trees in search of that one nucleotide polymorphism that controls needle drop. This heroic mission requires remarkable attention to detail. For example, in Puyallup, Washington, a research specialist lifts each of several thousand sample branches in her lab one by one, rubs her fingers up and down each stem, then counts the needles that fall from each one. Another specialist enters the number into an ever-spreading spreadsheet. It's a tedious job, but someone has to do it. Or not. Really, of all the problems facing American consumers and agriculture, should Christmas needle retention be this high on our list of research priorities? Well, responds the chief needle drop pathologist at Washington State, the Christmas tree industry is a $1 billion industry. This is Jim Hightower saying, exactly. So let this profitable industry pay for its own research, rather than diverting our tax funds and government scientists from more important work that will produce much greater public benefit.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Most of them are not in sympathy with the union. There's a small group in the union that is, and that's typical of an organization like that, and it's typical of Congress, it's typical of unions, it's typical of companies, I guess. The NRA is another place where the membership, if you do the polling, doesn't agree with the leadership.
The billionaire himself, wow, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and you go... Multiple billionaire. Not just a billionaire, a multiple billionaire. Pointing the fingers, ah, it's those unions. Yeah, good stuff. This whole gun thing has just been weighing on my mind. And, you know, I've had a couple of these conversations, and I do want to have more because I want a little more information. But what I find interesting is that the folks who are the pro-gun folks have taken a very strict, we're anti-government, we don't want government. And they're generally your very conservative, anti-government types. Kind of like the guy I talked to when I was in Disney. And what I found interesting about those folks is they didn't seem to have a problem with corporations having all of your information. In fact, I just saw a story that Disney is coming out with a Magic Plus plan where they give you a wristband, you know, like one of those... Oh, those rubber wristbands that you get for, whatever cause. Well, in that is going to have an RFID chip, and it'll be your room key. It'll be your pass to get in and out of the parks. It'll be your fast passes. It'll be your credit card. It'll be everything. This little wristband, put it on your, it's everything. Not so much of a problem with that. Oh, that's efficient. Oh, we love that. Oh, can't wait. And I've had those conversations with people in the park. Couldn't wait for it. It's going to make my experience here so much better. And I'm going, but you don't mind that they have all of your information in one little, very small little chip that can be read? You don't have a problem with that? And I remember the whole fight over Real ID, where the conservatives, and a very conservative guy, James Sensenbrenner, Republican from Wisconsin, in the dead of night, inserted this Real ID thing into a defense appropriation bill. Just snuck it in there. So now, honestly, the law of the land is that every one of us, all of us, will have an RFID chip in our driver's license. We will have something that policemen can drive down the street with a speed gun, a radar gun, and point it at us and go, oh, there's so-and-so, and that's where he lives, and there's all the information. all of this information in one little card. And they've trained us to accept this. But yet, I hear my right-wing friends, not a problem. Oh, that's okay. You want to talk about tyranny? I mean, really, honestly, I mean, be consistent. I mean, I question it. I'm not thrilled with it. So I see this story from Texas. Because I got to be honest with you, if my kid came home and said, "Dad, they gave me this thing to wear. They want to know. They want a radio locator around my neck." Dad would be pissed. Dad would not be happy. And, well, a girl, Andrea Hernandez, 15. Her father, not happy. Because the San Antonio Northside School District, they decided, well, we want all of our kids to wear little cute little badges with an RFID chip in it so that we can follow them, so that we know where they are. And they made it very clear, we're not following them. We just want to know where they are. if you can check the distinction, I don't have one. Evidently, though, the court, the U.S. District Court, down there in Texas, Judge Orlando Garcia, he ruled that, you know what? San Antonio's Northside School District, they have the right to expel the girl who refuses to wear the RFID chip, the radio frequency identification chip. And, you know, I started thinking about this. I remember when my daughter was born. She was born back in 2002. And I think it was because, I think the only rationale that someone would have picked me, the salesperson would have picked me out, is because we had actually stored my daughter's cord blood from when she was born, which was at the time was unheard of. In fact, the doctor had no idea what it was. We had to have someone call and explain what it was. And just real quick, when my daughter was born, before they cut the cord, they extracted the blood that was in the umbilical cord, and it was cryogenically frozen it, because, and whether you buy it or don't, supposedly the stem cells, her virgin stem cells, you're never going to get anything to match your body like that. Evidently, at this point, they can cure leukemia with it. They believe diabetes in the future, and there's so many with the advent of stem cell research and us being able to actually do some now that the Supreme Court said so. Who knows what they're going to do in 10, 20, 30 years. So I did it for all the kids. I still think it was expensive, but I still think it was the right thing to do because it's going to give them a chance in the future. But when I did this, at the time it was the new technology, I also was approached by a salesman at the hospital who said, "Hey, we've got this new technology." I go, "Oh yeah, what is it?" "Well, there's a lot of stuff going on," he said. "A lot of people abducting kids, and you see it in the news all the time." I said, "Yeah, only I realize that it's actually gone down over the years. It's just that we're hearing about it more often. But go ahead, go with your pitch." "Well, what we can do, you'll never have to worry about your daughter being abducted. You'll never have to worry about losing her in the mall." "Oh yeah? What do you want me to do?" "Well, we can just inject this little kernel of rice into the fatty part of her upper arm. It's an RFID chip, a radio frequency identification chip, and you can locate her if she's ever lost." And I go, "Wow, that sounds like a great idea. Do you have one?" "Well, no. It's good for children." I'm going, "But then you'll know where she is." And you start thinking this stuff through, because it sounds like a decent idea. It sounds like, you know what? I don't want my kid to be abducted. I don't want her to be lost. Sounds reasonable to an idiot. And I said, "No, thank you. I appreciate the time." And then a couple years later, you had Tommy Thompson, who was the head of Health and Human Services, who had left the Bush administration and was advocating the V-chip, basically what this guy was selling me. And I still haven't found out if he was ever chipped. I highly doubt it. But he was advocating for people to do just that. what this guy back in 2002 wanted to do to my daughter. And, you know, I had this conversation with my daughter over just a couple of days ago. And this is interesting how this falls into place, because I was explaining her to this story. And, you know, she's like, I don't want any part of that. And I go, exactly, which is why I didn't do it. And we had this whole conversation about technology, and because I just got her a cell phone. And there's a lot of things in that. Hey, you know, there's you know, all the GPS stuff and all the tracking that can be in that. And we were just having a conversation. So I see this story, and, you know, this is what school districts are going to do. And as I read through the story, and it's one of those moments where you're almost dumbfounded, where it stopped me in my tracks, because, you know, my first thought was, well, you know, they're concerned about the students, so, you know, they want to be able to, you know, make sure that I can see the rationale. I can almost understand their justification, because, you know, times are, you know, there are crazy things going on, and, you know, I don't want anyone to be abducted, and, you know, that's the angle that I think I would have taken. You read down to the article, and what evidently the district told the reporter is that because of Texas law, oh man, because Texas law counts students at the beginning of the day, so like at homeroom, for instance, you take a head count at homeroom, and if you have, let's say, 20 of the 30 kids who are supposed to be in homeroom, the school district, the state only pays the school district so much money because, well, there are only so many students in the school. So they're paying for the number of students in the classroom, which I guess was an idea that, you know, a lot of people thought, oh, that's a great idea. We need to make sure the kids are going to class, and I'm all in favor of that. So we're paying. The reason they got into this technology is that they said that they were losing $1.7 million a year because students, get this, students were loitering in the stairwells. They were chatting in the hallway. So they weren't counted, so they lost money. So they're going to have this technology to make sure that they could then know that they were in the building. Not that they were in class, that they were in the building. And I'm going, well, wait a second. Wasn't the intent of the law to make sure the kids got to class and learned? Not that they just showed up, were warm bodies in a hallway that you could track with an RFID chip? And look, I'm amazed that only one person out of the 100,000-person school district said no. But you look at the gun issue. You got people who are rabid. I mean rabid. But this, nothing. Is it that they don't get this? I mean, you had a commentator on fake news saying, well, it's like Stalin, and it's like Hitler. It's like papers, please, he said. This, my friends, this RFID stuff, this is paper, please. And it's the law of the land. Now, a number of states have sued to not implement it, Pennsylvania being one of them, and the Obama administration has not pushed it. But this is what the Bush administration wanted. And the reason I bring that up is because, you know, we hear a lot of rhetoric from the right, the people who tell us they're the defenders of our freedom. Yet they're the ones who wanted and got passed through the Patriot Act. And look, Bill, I'm with you, man. I was against the Patriot Act. Dead set against it. I was against the way we ended up going to war, and I'm against a lot of the stuff that we sent people into harm's way. I'm against the use of drones. But when you bring this stuff up, people, I guess they gloss over. This is a direct. How many people, you know, when I first moved to Pennsylvania, this is one of those things that blew my mind. And I've been here for 20 years now. When I first moved here, there were actually people, and it took me by surprise, there were actually people with driver's license without a picture on it. In fact, my ex-wife, her driver's license did not have a picture on it. How far have we come? I mean, I rented a hotel recently, and they swiped my driver's license. Yep, we got all your information. Here it is. On New Year's Eve, we went to the casino just to, you know, hear the band and have a drink and, you know, whatever. And as people were walking through the door, they're scanning people's driver's license. Now, the rationale was, well, we want to make sure that they're of age. They're scanning their driver's license. And I'm going, I have a real problem with that. Are they capturing all of the information on my driver's license? Because I don't know if you realize that little strip on the back has a ton of information. But it's interesting to me with all the rabid response to the guns, that not so much on the driver's license. I don't know. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this with Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year. If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Some interesting story out of Florida. A woman decided she was going to leave her 4 kids in a hotel room, go off, party, have a high old time. Turns out the kids were between 11 and, I think, 6 months. The 11-year-old lost. Didn't know where the room was. So what you have is you have a room full of screaming kids and no adult there to take care of them. She was arrested, charged, second time for child endangerment. Interesting plea, though. She's going to not be allowed to have children for 13 years. She agreed to not have children for 13 years in order to stay out of jail. I wonder how enforceable that is. It'll be interesting. I wonder what the right wing will say. But an interesting case nonetheless. To find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world, I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for me.
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm great. You know, back from the big holiday, finally getting some things straightened out with my grandmother who had a heart attack last week.
Oh, my gosh. How old was she?
She's 84.
Oh, wow.
It was a mild one, but, you know, when you're 84, even a mild one is, you know, real trouble. So we had taken a day off to head back and, you know, deal with some things there. She's had some health problems. And thank God, you know, and I said when I came back, thank God for Medicare. Because she doesn't have to worry about, am I going to be homeless when I come out of the hospital?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, I look at her. And
if we don't have that, what are we going to have?
Yeah, I mean, I look at her and the whole debate over do we have to have vouchers or... She's uninsurable by any stretch of the imagination. 84 years old, had a heart valve replaced, had a hip replaced, had a knee replaced, has congestive heart failure, all this stuff. No insurance company in their right mind would insure her at any rate, which is why we, the taxpayer, we've done that.
You know what I pay for health insurance per month?
I can't imagine.
I'm missing an eye, and I'm 61 years old.
$1,500 a month.
$2,041.
Wow. And, you know, who can afford that? I mean, that's $24,000.
That's more than my pay for rent.
Wow. But, hey, Ellen, we'll give you a voucher. We'll give you a golden ticket. We'll give you a couple hundred bucks.
Right. That's not going to solve my problem.
and as you get older, of course, that's going to go up, correct?
Well, I don't know if they didn't do this in anticipation of the Affordable Care Act coming into practice next year. So we'll see.
Yeah, it's outrageous. So what's going on in D.C.? Of course, the gun issue everywhere. All I've heard today is Obama's going to issue. There's going to be an executive order, and they're going to come house to house. Jackbooted thugs are going to steal my slingshot and my pea shooter and my pellet gun.
Yes. Well, it's kind of interesting because. Today, the Drudge Report put a picture of Stalin and Hitler comparing basically the president possibly making an executive order or so to that. Now, it's interesting because Stalin and Hitler did come in to power because of the use of guns. So how is the president compared to these guys? But secondly, one of the things that I think they may be taking a look at as an executive order, if they can, is if you are in trouble with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, AFT, and you're also in trouble with the folks at the FBI, there is no way, or one or the other, and not one and the other, there's no way the two of them can compare information.
Right.
Well, that's just crazy for a criminal background check.
But wouldn't you think that would have been something we would have taken care of after 9/11?
That's exactly what we should have taken care of after 9/11. And I'm shocked we haven't. I just don't understand that, Rick Smith.
I mean, is it the power of the NRA? I mean, or is it just an oversight?
I don't know. That would be a very interesting thing to find out. We don't, at this point, I just found out about it today.
Yeah, because I've got friends who believe that guns should be like chewing gum. The government shouldn't know where you're. Nobody. There should be no controls whatsoever. It should be a product.
And so it's easier to get a gun license or not to eat or to carry a gun than it is to drive a car.
Yeah, it should be easier to get a dog license. It should be harder to get a dog license than a gun license in some of my friends' mind.
Crazy.
Yeah, well, but, you know, the reality is, you know, we've been, for all of these years, we've been told repeatedly, and the media is doing it again, oh, they're going to take the guns. And I haven't seen any of this. Nobody's talking about going into individuals' houses and taking the shotgun they've got in the corner or the handgun they've got in the drawer. I've heard nothing of that. Yet all I hear from the right is that this is what's coming. Oh, this is how it starts. We're down the slippery slope. They're going to come and take our howitzer. Oh, they're going to take our 22 next.
Wow. I mean, it's crazy. And I think that some of the things the president might come up with are not going to be off the wall. I just, you know me, I'm so left-wing about this that I think they ought to outlaw football.
So then, well, let's not go there then, because you know football's coming up this weekend, and I have to have something to do. But you know, what legislation is out there? I know Feinstein has come out with something. Senator Blumenthal, I think, has some legislation.
Yes, he is trying to get some legislation, and some of this would be legislation that would, in fact, allow the AFT and the FBI to talk to each other. Little items like that. In addition, limiting the number of bullets that somebody could get, limiting Teflon bullets, which apparently can pierce body armor worn by police and presidents and things like that.
Great. Let's talk about another right-wing talking point, the Fed. Senator Bernie Sanders doesn't want anyone there who has a conflict of interest.
That's right. Basically, what happened with the Fed is that there have been people who, in fact, there's just one recent resignation on the Fed from somebody that is a Wall Street guy. And so Bernie Sanders said, basically, we cannot have this. You can't have the foxes watching the chicken house. In fact, it's the J.P. Morgan Chase guy, Jamie Dimon, who's just resigning, and he's saying, hey, with people like that, they don't belong on the Fed. And he would like to have legislation to keep those people off the Fed.
I'm with you. I think people like you and me should be sitting on some of those boards, much like, you know, we had someone from the Hyatt, a Hyatt worker who wants to sit on the Hyatt board. I think workers should sit on corporate boards. I think average everyday people should be sitting on the board. We should be seeing what's going on in these back rooms.
Right. And that's what Bernie Sanders is trying to do.
Yeah. I see that Hilda Solis resigned today. Any news on who the replacement is going to be there?
Not at all. And I know one of her deputy secretaries, and I'm sure I think this came as a complete shock. So the question is, as Hilda Solis wrote, you know, she went home and she decided to resign and all that kind of stuff. Well, the question is, was she really asked to resign? And that's the sort of cover letter, or did she really decide that? Because I'm telling you, her underlings at the department are in shock.
Yeah, wow. I liked her. I thought she did a good job. And the Jack Lew going to be the Treasury Secretary, I guess. Huh?
It looks like that. Of course, he has to get confirmed, but we don't see that as a problem.
Yeah, where do you see him? You know, some of the things I've read on him are kind of a mixed bag. Not overly
definitely
friendly.
Definitely a mixed bag.
Not overly friendly to workers, but seems to be good on some poverty issues.
Right. He's clearly he has the president's confidence. He's going to have to deal with debt issues.
Right.
And we just don't know where he's going to come down.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in the camp. I wasn't a huge Geithner fan. Sorry. Not a big fan. So almost anything better than that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that, and also because he is so close to the president as his chief of staff, I think that this will work pretty well.
What did you think of AIG, the people that are thinking about possibly, and I see today that they've decided not to sue you and me because we bailed them out. What did you think of that?
I thought that was the only decision that they could have made. They would have gotten such negative publicity, would have probably put them into bankruptcy again.
I mean, even and I guess you almost, as the company, you have to think about it because you could probably, now, are they going to be opened up to lawsuits against the guy who's filing this?
You know, the guy that's filing this was the former CEO, and I don't know that he was the CEO. I don't think he was at the time.
No, he wasn't. He actually had gotten the boot over a accounting scandal.
Right. So I think that he obviously was a stockholder, feels he got a rotten deal, and feels he can go after the government.
It's a damn shame. I guess, you know, it's like, you know, if someone saves me from drowning, I'm going to sue the guy for, you know, rip my shirt when you pulled me out of the water from drowning. It's just nuts. The big inauguration's coming up very soon, planning on being there. I see some pretty big names going to come and perform.
Well, we have Beyonce is going to be playing, singing, and also James Taylor is going to sing My Country Tis of Thee.
There you go. I can't wait. I'm planning on taking my two kids down to see history again. I took my daughter 4 years ago to the first one, and now my 6-year-old son wants to go as well. So we're hoping to go and have a good time with it.
Well, I think that it's going to be amazing. I can't wait to see you and spend some time with you. And there's a big parade going on, so it should be fun.
All right, Ellen, it's great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Great.
Look forward to seeing you at the inauguration. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. From the top.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky. An asteroid you might not have known to worry about has been given the all clear.
Astronomers thought that this asteroid had the potential to collide with Earth in the year 2040. But data from the Gemini Observatory in Hawaii has shown that this asteroid will not collide with Earth. This asteroid is called 2011 AG5. It's about 140 meters in diameter, about the length of two American football fields.
Astronomers agree that if this object were to collide with the Earth, it would release several thousand times as much energy as the atomic bombs that ended World War II. Statistically, they say, a body of this size should impact the Earth on average every 10,000 years. But 2011 AG5 will not hit us in 2040.
Why do we hear so much nowadays about asteroids passing near Earth? The fact is that astronomers are now actively looking for asteroids that come near Earth, and that's why they're finding them. A telescopic survey of the sky, called the Mount Lemmon Survey, found asteroid 2011 AG5. This survey is specifically designed to look for asteroids that pass near Earth.
Astronomers found 2011 AG5 early in the year 2011. They had to observe its orbit long enough to be certain of it, to learn that Earth no longer falls along a possible future path for this asteroid in 2040. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
We don't think of the bottom, we do it full of Rick and Smith.
Okay, nice meeting you.
I mean, for me, shy probably doesn't even begin to describe it.
Yeah, I was
painfully shy, terrified. Is more. I can't. All the horrors you couldn't. That time machine I from time to time talk about wanting to build. There's one setting that will never go on it. I will never, ever, ever go back and either be or watch me be an adolescent. I mean, just the unmitigated terror of picking up a phone and saying, "You want to go to the dance?"
Yes.
Because the rejection fear was just crippling.
Yeah, I don't know why I was that way too, and maybe I just learned to let people be themselves, to let a woman make her own decisions, and not even try to, you know, not con, not force, not bullshit. Well, when you play in a band, you're certain, especially a blues musician, you were a. It was a funny situation to play these college bars, and I don't know. I was older than some of these kids, and you could be as friendly as you wanted with me, and when you wanted to stop being friendly that evening, fine, you know. And what happened? Women just told me they were very much at ease with me after a while. They just they said you were kind of a trustworthy. I said yeah, I bullies. Bothered me, whether it's some male guy trying to bully me, he bothered me to the point sometimes where whatever object I had to put in my hand to knock him on his ass, I would do it. And maybe I got
well. And Bill, I think you bring another aspect into the conversation that is of value, and that is the self same people who will engage in unwanted males who will engage in unwanted advances. Are also the same males who, I mean, well, you probably weren't listening last night, but you know when that goober Alex Jones challenged Piers Morgan to a boxing match, or like I said at the time, any of the horror stories of a drunken and unbearable Ernest Hemingway, we'll go outside and fight us, what we'll do. Yeah, they were equally noxious to women and men.
Yeah, they didn't really care. They wanted to fight with somebody, and they found out as I got older they made a mistake because I could afford heavy, you know, small heavy weaponry, and it was just as nuts. You know, I did 4 years in the Catholic Children's Home, and fight, yeah, like hell, from age 9 to 13, some of the nastiest, dirtiest, Bob kids. I don't think suburban kids in the 50s ever fought the way we did. I mean, it was whatever it took to end this situation quickly, we would do. But women would talk to me about music, and fine, I appreciated it because, number one, I appreciated the fact that they were there spending their money and helping me make a living doing something I love to do. That was enough. And there was a lot of women who I hung out with, a lot of the women who were, let's say, I was 35. Some of these women were 40 or 45, and they were the leaders in the women's movement. And being around them, I learned an awful lot. You keep your eyes open and watch and listen, and you learn. And some of these guys, well, you said, they were the ones who were obnoxious to women. They were also the most obnoxious to me. At the end of the night, if they couldn't get anybody to go anywhere with them, they wanted to go out with somebody. And it was ridiculous. And I just learned to let people do what they decided to do. And it cost me a marriage. But I didn't start the situations. I just was there. I was no saint, that's for damn sure. But you didn't lean on people. You let people make the decision of what they do with their life is theirs, not mine. And it's to this day, I have a lot of friends, women friends that I had affairs with, relationships with. But when they decided to call it, it was over. When they decided to start it, it started. And maybe I made mistakes too because I destroyed my own marriage in the long run. But I had a real... there was a woman who was a friend of mine who she'd been a neighbor. And I catch two guys at this one bar running their mouths, and I called her aside and I said, you stay away from those guys. I'll tell you next week. And I told her, and she said, well, thank you. I said, well, I've seen it before. I've seen it and I've heard it before. And it was a funny time. That was I was there when the liberation movement was getting started, getting rolling. And the bars I was playing were, you know, blues bars were, in those days were a lot of, they were connected with college neighborhoods and very intelligent people. Of course, a lot of them got very drunk, too, but including me once in a while.
Well, you know, in saying that that relationships are not best built on intoxication is not to say, is not the same as, you know, suddenly me morphing into Carry Nation.
Yeah, I was not a prohibitionist, you know. My second wife was...
I think a corollary to this, Bill, is that if you feel like, and I don't mean you, if a person feels like either they or their prospective partner need to be inebriated in order to engage in some sort of hoped for sexual liaison, the whole scene is built on sand.
Oh, yeah, it's not going to last, you know, very long. And I was just around the extremes of the hippie movement. I started hanging out with in a church-run coffee house in the 1960s when there were guys coming through this church trying to get people to go down and register vote. Some ministers and people who were very active in that one, too. It was a very strange time to be 1960s, 61, 62, and on out. There were things changing and happening right before your eyes. And I look back on my own past and say, well, Bill, you made a few mistakes along the way, you know. Luckily for me, as I say, I was just, whatever the person that was with me wanted to be, just, you know, they could be it. It's not, you know, I didn't try to change people or to push them in any direction. I'm just there, you know. And, of course, the music was, I'm not saying commercially, but there was something about the playing of the kind of music we did, the people I worked with, that was just emotionally moving to a lot of people. And these college bars were strange places. You probably hung out in them. You know what I'm saying.
I know exactly, and I know the smell and everything. Hey, Bill, I hate to do it, but I got to get out of here because we're on top of the end of the program. Hopefully we'll hear from
you. I appreciate the help so much. You will hear from me. And this may not be the right number. The call on, I don't know.
This is the studio line.
Okay, because I've been trying to get through, and this has been one heck of a show, and it was a weird time to be. And again, I was a white kid in a minority in the neighborhood I grew up in, and which is why I ended up playing the music I ended up playing. Anyway, I appreciate it. I'll catch you. Yeah, thanks to everybody, and of course Isaac has been wonderful with me, and I appreciate it so much, and appreciate the